Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, May 22nd, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network or you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our participant code is 449389. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send questions to questions, that's plural questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is Matthew chapter 9. Verses 1 through 13. That's Matthew chapter 9, verses 1 through 13. And he, the Lord Jesus, entered into a ship and passed over and came unto his own city. And behold, they brought to him a man sick of the palsy, lying on a bed. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said unto the sick of the palsy, Son, be of good cheer, thy sins are be forgiven thee. And behold, certain of the scribes said within themselves, This man is blasphemous. And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, Wherefore think ye evil in your hearts? For whether it is easy to say, Thy sins be forgiven thee, or to say, Arise and walk. But that ye may know that the Son of Man hath power on earth to forgive sins, then saith he to the sick of the palsy, Arise, take up thy bed, and go unto thine house. And he arose and departed to his house. And when the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God, which had given such power unto men. And as Jesus passed forth from thence, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the receipt of customs. And he said unto him, Follow me. And he arose and followed him. And it came to pass, as Jesus sat at meat in the house, behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto his disciples, Why eateth your master with publicans and sinners? But when Jesus heard that, he said unto them, They that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. But go ye and learn what that meaneth, and I will have mercy and not sacrifice. For I am not come to call the righteous, but the sinners to repentance. Okay, that was Matthew chapter 9, verses 1 through 13. All right, I sent out an email over the weekend, basically looking for affidavits. We're going to start putting affidavits into our court case. And so anybody has an affidavit, but the affidavit has to have a specific focus. It's got to be something where someone was denied due process, someone who has been abused by the courts, someone maybe, you know, we're doing the foreclosures, which we'll continue to do that, but we'll probably add those affidavits for the foreclosures. Well, they will be added onto the site anyway. And also the habeas corpuses that we've done, we're going to add that in. And hopefully soon we'll get back to habeas corpuses. But right now we are pursuing the non-judicial foreclosures, which is a lack of due process. But any other lack of due process or violation of an unalienable right, if anybody has been imprisoned for exercising an unalienable right or imprisoned for a clear case that, you know, where maybe the court is serving corporate America and not the people, obviously, and people have been imprisoned for that, or people who have been abused in the prison system, okay? These are the kind of affidavits we want. So people, we're not looking for anyone to, you know, definitely not looking for traffic violations, obviously. We're looking for serious problems, serious situations. So we set up a special email, and it's affidavit, and I think it's plural, affidavits, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Affidavits at nationallibertyalliance.org. So if anybody has an affidavit they would like to include into the court case, now we have made contact, not directly, indirectly, well, not even indirectly, really. We sent a letter to Jeff Sessions, that's the Attorney General, and also copied numerous other people, of course the President and a few others, concerning the case. And a copy of that letter to a few individuals, and again the president, concerning you know, the abuse of courts and the, you know, cases of RICO and murder and so on, and that went out. Goodness, I think about a week ago. It wasn't this past week? I think it was the week before. As a matter of fact, it was the week before that went out, and they should have been getting it at the beginning of this past week that just passed by. And we're going to give him a couple of weeks. We'll wait till the president gets back home. He's, I believe, overseas. He's going to be traveling for, I think, 10 days or something like that. But whatever it is, when he gets back into Washington, that's when maybe we'll start to pursue to see what Jeff, you know, the Attorney General is doing. But anyway, any case that we do put into the case is really a complaint, more than a complaint. It's an accusation. Really people declaring their innocence and the fact that they've been abused by the courts, and it's going to become part of this court case. In the long run, at some point in time, the case has to be heard within our case. Now, there are certain cases that we're doing show causes with. You know, as I mentioned, the foreclosure cases, we're going to be doing show causes to certain judges and pulling them into this court. show causes on the justice out there in Oregon with the wildlife preserve and the justice out in Nevada with the Bundy case. So we're going to be doing show causes on them also, and then we're going to continue to pursue criminal charges against these people for violating our unalienable rights and actually warring against the Constitution and warring against we the people. So those are the things we're doing with those cases. And, of course, all of the foreclosure cases, as I mentioned, both tax foreclosures and mortgage foreclosures, which are non-judicial foreclosures, we're pursuing that and show causes and eventually criminal charges against all those judges. We also, of course, are going forward on all of the habeas corpuses that have not been adhered to and not even considered. They've been just concealed or removed or whatever. There was a couple of cases, I think, where they actually just mailed them back. But most of them have concealed them and or removed them or did something with them, but they have not been heard and they've been ignored. So the more cases we put into our case, the more evidence we're just producing. We're going to show across the nation that this is consistency, a consistency between all of these judges and all of these court cases, showing the fact that there is a conspiracy. So anybody who wants to send in an affidavit into this case, again, write it up. We did send an email. We asked for basic information, very simple information. I don't have that list before me, but generally speaking, we want your name, your phone number, your address, the name of the court, the individuals involved. We're not looking for a list of many individuals, but particularly the judge, maybe. In most cases, it could be a prison, a particular prison situation. Maybe the whoever is responsible for the prison. You know, in the case of a county jail, it's the sheriff. But in the case of these other state prisons, for instance, whoever's in charge of them would be responsible for the abuse that goes on in that prison. Federal prison, whoever would be, a commissioner or somebody, whoever would be in charge of that. So we want the list of those individuals, and then we would call you back when we get the affidavits. We're working on getting someone to handle this. We don't have anyone to handle it at the moment. We have a couple of people we're going to approach and talk to about it, we think can handle it. And then they're going to go through the affidavits. We don't want to try the case in an affidavit. We don't want any more than a couple of pages, and unless it's an absolute necessity that it's that big a case, it's got that many, twists and turns in it, so to speak. But generally speaking, we don't want to try the case. We don't want to get involved with the man on the land stuff or any of those things. We want to be very serious and talk about just the facts. On or about a certain date, this happened or that happened. Now, we do have an affidavit that people can take a look at, really a guideline or something for an affidavit, shall I say. I don't remember exactly where that's at. Do you know where that's at, Jan? On the website where people can get a framework for an affidavit?
Go to the grand jury tab and then click the non-judicial foreclosure tab and scan down a few lines, and it's right there. It says affidavit download.
Right. Okay, and that affidavit will give you the basic guidelines. It's got the opening statement, the closing statement with, for the notary that's going to sign it and bear witness. But in between, get some basic information, which really tells you all we want is the facts. On or about a certain time or a certain date and a certain time, this happened, that happened, the other thing happened. And just tell your story and don't get lost in trying the case and don't get lost in trying to use magic words that's going to, keep us in some jurisdiction that they're going to ignore anyway. It doesn't mean anything. So let's just tell the story. Before anyone gets anything notarized, I want to make this clear. Before anybody gets anything notarized, you first want to write the affidavit, do it in Microsoft Word or some Word program. There is another – what's that program out there that's not Microsoft Word, but it's a free one, a Microsoft Office, free Office or something? Do you know? Jen? Gerard?
Either LibreOffice or OpenOffice.
OpenOffice. Okay. So both of any one of those two, those word processors and those two, those are free if you don't have Word. But if you got Word, use Word, and you'll be contacted by somebody who will go through your affidavit and make sure that it's focused and it's something that we can work with. Someone's going to be making those decisions on what ones we'll take. And generally speaking, I'm sure we'll take most of them. But sometimes people will come up with some things that just aren't appropriate for us to take into this court case. But anyway, we'll keep that focused. And once they make contact with you back to maybe make any corrections or suggestions and then have you get the affidavit finally signed and then mailed into us or emailed into us, if you keep the original, send us a copy of the affidavit by email. You know, you can scan it. It must be a PDF. Once you get it done, it must be scanned in PDF. We don't want a picture. We don't want anything other than a PDF. So we have to be able to scan it into PDF. If you don't know how to do that, and there are a few people from time to time I find that they don't know how to do that on their printers, try to find someone who will help you and show you. It's just a matter of pushing the button and ordering it and the scan in a PDF. But if you can't figure that out or for some reason it doesn't work, you'll have to take your affidavit down to Staples or Office Max or someplace and have it scanned and put onto a thumb drive and then back into your computer and then email to us. But it must be a PDF. We're not accepting anything other than PDFs at the final draft of your affidavit. And then we will put it into the court case. At some point in time, it will be dealt with within this court case because everything is being taken serious. And we're looking at all of these cases collectively as showing subversion against the United States of America, war against the Constitution, war against the people, and so on. So anyway, that's something we're doing right now. Anybody wants to put it in, an affidavit, get it to us.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
I want to just make a correction what I told that woman with the Amish farmer that was due for sentencing this week. Might be too late already, and I told her to fill out the affidavit over there, but really, they waited so long that they really need a show cause. So if she's on here, she should get a hold of us and talk to us, because by the time they wait for our process to go through, I mean, this is a special case. It's kind of notorious. They're putting this guy in jail for making, not labeling his health products correctly. And that's a case that we could probably get behind and help him with. So he needs to call.
Well, absolutely. That's a case we'll do a show cause on. And I know, Jan, you're looking for that person.
Right. We have August Gerard on the call tonight. In fact, if you want to talk to him now, I can unmute him.
In a few minutes. Let me finish up with some other details first.
Yeah, I just wanted to correct that because I didn't mean to push him off. I thought it was important to get his affidavit, but... at that late hour, he'll be long gone before he gets off. Okay.
We'll let them talk in a few minutes, Dan. Okay.
Okay.
We're also looking for other cases. Inventors, people who have been threatened, anything where the federal government is suppressing, threatening, any place where you're being abused in the courts, in the prisons, or by the government in any way. Look at even the IRS. The IRS is a big abuser, and we're going to be going after them too soon. But, we'll start collecting those also if you have anything for the IRS. We're not going to post them up. Well, I think we will post them up. We'll post them up, but eventually we're going to pursue, go directly into that hornet's nest because they need to be dealt with. But again, we are organizing. We've got over 6,000 members and climbing. We've got a lot of leadership. But we're trying to really get everyone involved, and we've been having meetings before the meeting, so to speak, just for organizing. And we're trying to organize all the states, make sure that we have representatives from each state as a state coordinator, and then start working down into the county organizers and getting a lot of people activated down on the county level to start organizing people within their county to get focused in on this. anybody who's aware of anybody else that has, you know, there's a lot of people out there that have done investigations either for one reason or another, maybe because they saw the abuse or they were being abused, and they started to collect a lot of information and take affidavits and trying to do things in the court and unable to get anywhere with those cases. Those are the cases we're interested in. We're also interested in cases that have been brought into the courts and then people have been abused, of course. We want to deal with those cases, too. But anybody who has gathered a lot of information, we want a partnership with them. We want to assist them and bring them into our court case, again, because, you know, the only way we're going to deal with these problems is collectively. And this has always been the main focus of National Liberty Alliance to get to this point. This has always been the plan to spearhead. We've never spoken about it, how exactly we're going to do it, but this is it. And if you want to know how we've opened a court of record or how we opened an Article III court, then you should be reading a memorandum that we just recently put in about 2 weeks ago. I think it's 1023, and that it's called a brief and a memorandum, but it's a brief. And it explains exactly how this court case is operating and how we're going forward, which is going to be according to the law, according to the Constitution, according to the common law. You know, we're doing the best we can on how we might do that. We have an unalienable right to have courts of justice. We have an unalienable right to have our cases heard in jurisdictions known, which is the common law, or the law of the land, however you want to put it. And we want justice in our courts. That's what we want. And so that's our battle, and that's what we're doing, and that's our fight. So, again, anybody that's got anything, or anybody that knows anybody that's got cases that, a case that they're working on, again, inventors, you know, we know of inventors that have been killed, people who have found cures for different ailments, and they've been killed. Or have been threatened or whatever. But other people have picked up the torch in those areas and continued on, and it's like a battle going uphill. We'd like to assist those people. So anybody knows anybody, you know, we're interested. Let me see, before we move on, let's do questions first, Jan. Do we have any questions out there?
We do. The first question is, since the states created the federal government and the list of enumerated powers in the U.S. Constitution is sparse, does that not make the state constitutions supreme except in those above areas mentioned?
Well, you know, again, the Bill of Rights is the key to our liberty. The Bill of Rights is the key to interpretation of all law, all constitutions. Anything that is repugnant to the Constitution is null and void. That's an agreed-upon position, and, of course, many times repeated by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so anything that violates that is the key. You know, Congress has been given certain authority and powers, and, you know, each state has a representation for instance, the states are supposed to control the Senate. In other words, two senators from every state, 50, 100 senators. And the states are supposed to have control of those senators. They're the ones that are supposed to vote them into office, and they can remove them and replace them at their own will, because they're supposed to be getting state representation. But they're not. That's been subverted. They've taken that away from the states, and the states have no say to Congress. And, of course, the people have a say in Congress through the congressmen. And since both houses are totally controlled, you know, by special interest groups, they're given plenty of money to do this or to do that or do the other thing, and they just ignore the people. So they use the people to get into office. They tell them all the lies they want to tell them. Once they get into office, then they do the will of the special interest groups or the elite or whatever you want to call it. And therein is the problem. We did give Congress certain powers and authorities that the states cannot trample upon. They can't interfere with. We also gave the president certain authorities, and we gave the federal courts certain authorities. You know, the federal courts really are there to deal with constitutional issues. Okay, generally, that's really what they're there for. any kind of a case that arises out of a constitutional violation or concern, that's where federal courts are supposed to be involved. All the other cases and situations belong to the state. And any other powers, what's it, the 10th Amendment, that talks about any other powers are not mentioned in or so on and so forth, is to the states or the people respectively. So then it goes right back to the states. But no matter what the state constitution, a state constitution has, no matter what, if it violates any unalienable right of we the people, it's null and void. And that's the key, okay? You know, codes, they can't write codes and regulations and things like that for the people. They can only write codes and regulations for themselves, to control themselves. It's sort of policies and procedures with power. And that's what their codes and ordinances are supposed to be for. It has nothing to do with we the people. They should not be controlling our behavior. And if we injure somebody, we have to answer to the injury in a court of justice. And then we have to restore those people. If we've injured people or a person, we have to restore that person or people. And that's where the deterrence will come from. We don't need their statutes to deter us from anything or to put anything upon us. A lot of people are in jail for breaking their statutes, their codes, their regulations. But they can't put that upon people. So again, it's a pretty, I believe that it's the Bill of Rights that's the key to this whole thing, in my opinion, because again, you can, that's the measuring stick of, against any law. Does it measure any of my, does it affect or void, try to void out any of my unalienable rights? Does it prevent me from exercising any of my unalienable rights? That's the question to any legislation out there. And if it affects us in any way, it's null and void. That's the key. And of course, there's a lot more rights that we have other than what's recorded in the Bill of Rights, but that's the basic standard. And we can expand upon that pretty logically and easily, in my opinion. Okay, did I answer the question? Was there a second part to that or something? Jan? You have to unmute yourself.
No. Yeah, there was only one part to it, John. That's fine.
Okay.
Next question, then. Does estoppel take away good faith action, whether or not based on law?
Okay, estoppel, if I recall, isn't that a precedent? I don't remember what estoppel is. Gerard, do you remember what estoppel was? Well, Brent, maybe if you can pipe in, if you're here, maybe give us a definition of estoppel. No. I forget. I remember years ago, I don't really pay too much attention to it, but there is a, for instance, if a case has already been heard or something of that nature, they can do something that's called estoppel.
John?
Yeah, Brent, go right ahead.
This is Brent. Well, estoppel is a... it's a general principle that can be applied in many ways. And what it means, flat, it just means stop. It's a French, right, Norman word that means stop. The French always make the words longer. But it means that the other side is stopped. They say a stop from doing a certain thing or pleading a certain thing. But it can be applied in many different ways. And so that when I heard the question, I'm thinking, well, which estoppel are they talking about? And I don't know the answer to that, so I was thinking about how I'd respond, and I don't know. Maybe somebody can clarify later.
Well, I would think that anything used to stop my exercise of an unalienable right, as far as I'm concerned, is null and void. Anything used to stop a case from being heard, I think everybody has a right to being heard, and you can't stop that from happening. I mean, at least you got to be able to hear the case before you'd say something about it. And again, I'm not sure exactly how they mean it either. Did they get any more detail, or what,
no,
is that it?
No, they didn't.
And maybe they can get into more detail on that question, and then maybe
okay,
we can respond. But
okay.
It's been a while since I've heard that. I remember hearing about it in one of my days. Getting into the court. We did read about that stuff. But anyway.
Okay.
Thanks.
Next question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Every codified law must also be certified as constitutional by the Supreme Court of the state before it can become implemented. If this, or if one is charged with a violation of law, should he subpoena the certification of that law by that state Supreme Court and subpoena the state attorney general of that state to testify?
Yeah, I think that's getting too involved. I think things are very clear. If there's some law out there or some court holding up some statute and it violates our unalienable right, it's null and void, and that's what the case needs to be made. Going after this one or that one, how it was legislated and who said what, where, when, and how, I think this gets lost. The bottom line is if it violates me, it's null and void. If it violates any of the people, it's null and void. And I think we got to stay very clear. I see it as very simple. It's all about jurisdiction, due process, and our unalienable rights. It's about those three things. And any time they violate us, look, you'll find that one of those three things, if not more than those three, you know, if not two of the three things, or all three of those three things are being violated. As a matter of fact, every court case I've been in my opinion, is null and void ultimately because we're in jurisdictions unknown, and that's on the state level as well as on the federal level. And I'm talking about in criminal cases particularly, not necessarily the contract cases and arguments. There might be a lot of good stuff going on there, and things may be going well. Unless you're going up against corporate America, you're going to lose, and you'll lose every single time. But generally speaking, you'll find that these courts, they get out of jurisdiction. And I can't say all of them, but the ones that I've been to, so that I've seen in my experience pretty much, that's how it's been. So if they violate your unalienable rights, take you into a jurisdiction unknown, and refuse you your due process. You know, again, when you go back to an estoppel, okay, your right of due process is ultimately to be heard and considered. That's the key part to the whole thing here. So, but anyway, that's how I see it. Good.
Okay, good. The next question is only pertinent if you have read this article. This person has apparently filed something in the Supreme Court and has found something on the web that says, rest in peace, pro se litigants before the Supreme Court, blah, blah, blah. It sounds like they're trying to negate any pro se litigants from filing. Right. If you've read
they're not,
that...
They're not happy with pro se litigants.
No.
I mean, that's clear.
No.
So, I don't know what particularly they're talking about.
Right.
I know there's always been an attack on pro se litigants. They give you a really big problem if you go in there and try to help someone else and help represent or advise someone else. They give you a really hard time. Goodness, I had a hard time trying to, defend my wife in court. I mean, these people just don't stop. Who are they? Who the hell do they think they are, Constitution doesn't give anybody the right to a lawyer. They give them, the right to counsel. Whoever or wherever you want to get that counsel from is your business. I mean, it makes
right.
sense, of course. You want to get some kind of legal counsel, someone who understands basically what's going on. But generally speaking, it doesn't mean a bar lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But, anybody going into court without a lawyer is really subject to attack, and they will attack you and ignore you and push you aside and abuse you. It's just the nature of people to begin with, because a lot of these people are arrogant to begin with. There is an assault on the pro se people. But anyway, anything
okay,
else?
But yes, I have a couple questions from a recent member. It may be eye-opener for other recent members. The first question says, does the Second Amendment apply to everyday citizens and or only the militia? According to a recent article, an officer in our military revealed the government's plan to disarm Americans and throw them in FEMA camps, and she gives the you are.
Yeah, well,
for
look,
that.
That there's a simple answer to that because
yes.
You know, you can go into the New York State Constitution, and every single if there is an attack, right in the Constitution, New York State Constitution is every person. It doesn't say male or female; it just says every person is responsible to defend the state. Okay, and you can't defend the state without arms. But look at everyone is to be part of the every able-bodied man is to be part of the militia. Okay. And therefore, we're all part of the militia, so we need to have weapons. But besides that, we have unalienable rights to defend ourselves. We can expand the Second Amendment pretty easily. There is a separation by a comma or a semicolon or something there. But in any event, there are two points being made there, the right to bear arms and also the right to defend ourselves as a people, in other words, for the militia, for the purpose of a free state. Clearly that expands out to our own personal well-being, the right to defend ourselves, whether we defend ourselves with a weapon or some other way. We have that unalienable right to defend and protect ourselves if we're being assaulted or feel that we're being threatened or our life is being in jeopardy. So, and you can take that logic right out and continue that logic because we have an unalienable right to defend ourselves. All of the rest of the stuff is just BS trying to really confuse people and go to storytelling and do whatever they can to confuse people to wonder whether they have a right to bear an arm or not. And remember, if you have to ask your government or somebody else whether you have a right to bear arms, whether you have a right to have a weapon, you're under a slavery mentality. And it's unfortunate. I speak to myself first. I was under that slavery mentality years ago, wondering about the being able to right to have a weapon and whether I need a permit and all those things early on, because I was blinded by, that slavery mentality. No, I have a right to defend myself, and that's it, period. Nothing else to talk about. All right, anything else?
I have one last one, again, from a new member. If the Constitution of the United States states that all men are created equal, how is it that the elite owns all the wealth, not just in America, but on a global scale, as the 7 billion-plus humans on Earth remain helplessly enslaved by them? Was our American government infiltrated by them, and if so, that continues to be intact as the Constitution seems to be ignored by them all. Amen.
Well, look, at the enemies of liberty, the enemies of the people have infiltrated every government on this planet, and the United States very particularly were under very strong influence of the elite or whatever you want to call these people, the powers that be. And they control us in a couple of ways. They control us by controlling money. They control us by controlling religion. They control us by controlling our Congress, our laws. They control us by keeping us ignorant. We don't have the facts. We don't have the knowledge. Where do they teach the Constitution anymore? Certainly not in our schools. I'm sure they're taught in a few schools here or there, of course, but generally speaking, it's not taught in our grammar schools. It's not taught in our high schools or even our colleges. And whatever is taught is distorted. And they send out, armies of lawyers to make sure that, the powers that be and, whatever it is that they're doing, really pushing towards that new world order, is really protected and served to. A lot of lawyers are really serving the powers that be, and they're exercising all these statutes that violate us, our rights, and so on. So there is a war, and that's, if you read our paperwork, we're very clear. We're talking about enemies, both foreign and domestic, inside of our government. That's exactly what our case is about. And those enemies are inside of all governments. I mean, Russia has this problem, China has this problem, and any other nation, Israel has this problem, or the Arab nations have this problem. They all have this problem. and because we're fighting off the elitist, the people behind the scenes, the ones that control the money, and all the big powerful, you know, they control the military industrial complex. They control religion, generally speaking, and again, as I mentioned, money. They control our courts. They control the justice system. Look, you can't even get. They're not even afraid to violate your rights in a courtroom anymore. They're not even afraid to say, you ain't bringing a constitution into my courtroom. You know, my courtroom to begin with. You can't bring the constitution into my courtroom. You know, this is how these judges talk. I mean, who are these people? That's how bold they have come. That's how safe they feel where they're at. We need to show them difference. We need to call these people out, and we need to put these people in jail. Because that's what the jails really are for, I think, is for these people. So they've built their own prisons. We just need to get them in there. All right, anything else?
No, sir. That's all the questions for tonight.
Okay.
Are we ready?
Yeah. Do we have more than one person to bring anything up?
No, Robert has nothing tonight, so it'll just be our visitor, August Gerard, and Brent
maybe,
tonight, I guess.
Can you introduce them or have them introduce themselves and tell us?
Okay. August Gerard is the son of the fellow that was convicted, and I'm not sure if he's sentenced or not yet, of selling something as poisonous and terrible as milk that was not pasteurized. It's an absolutely ridiculous case, and I think he faces something like 68 years in jail for doing this. So without any more ado, I just unmuted you. August, if you're still there, please speak up, and we'd like to hear what you have to offer on this case.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you well.
Okay. I'm one of Samuel Gerard's sons. I'm still living at home. Samuel A. Gerard is sitting in jail for making natural sense. Samuel made three products sold all over, had many good reports. People using them. He was making chickweed healing salve almost 19 years. He sold it all over America. In 2002, after being in business since 99, the FDA showed up at the family farm about chickweed. They said skin cancer on my father's label they didn't like, which he had on the label, good for skin cancer, dry skin, cuts, burns, poison ivy. My father took it off. They said that's making a claim. Everything went good for about 10 years. In 2012, they, I guess, seen they're not getting no money. They got a hold of a lot that was just sold to a sales rep that was going to go distribute it to the stores. And that was in 2012. By now, the label again wasn't right. So time went on. Soon, comfrey and bloodroot wasn't safe. Dad had all three products tested. All came back clear. Later, we found out the FDA did their own testing where no drugs or poisonous found. The salve they got, my father had to pay to get it disposed. They're in Missouri. In 2013, they had an injunction where he couldn't sell. Dad went on a private membership. In 2015, he was indicted for selling mislabeling drugs. He went pro se. He's just an Amish farmer, father of 12 and 26 grandchildren. He put motion in to dismiss. The judge denied it. He appealed this case to the Sixth Circuit. After that, the lower court judge ordered another hearing. Dad didn't think he has to appear. Number one, it's in the Sixth Circuit. And number two, it didn't, in the body of the letter, say he has to be there. So, he didn't appear, so the federal marshals came to the farm. held my sisters, mom, all the kids at gunpoint till they searched the farm. Lots of children. Willingly knowing, because we told them Dad's not here. They did not tell us our rights when they arrived. They did not get him until January the 12th. After in prison, they took his photo going right against our religion. Furthermore, when he was arraigned in 2015, my father did not let them take photo at the hearing. Another hearing was scheduled and Dad won that issue. So why did they get it after it was granted? At trial, if I would have been on the jury bench, if I would not say he's guilty, I would have been afraid I would get in trouble. The judge had around 40 minutes of instruction, basically telling they need to find him guilty. Samuel is deeply rooted in the Amish faith, hardworking. We got a big farm, so yes, we need him home. There's a petition, Sally O. Boyle, Kentucky Free Press. There's over close to 30,000 signatures. If anybody knows how to get in contact with President Trump, you can drop us a card. If you know of any radio talk shows, get the word out. There's no victim. They did not bring anybody forth that was hurt, but they're treating him like a criminal.
Let me ask you a few questions, okay? Okay, so you said that the judge spent 40 minutes instructing the jury. Can you get a copy of that audio?
Yes.
Okay, if you can get a copy of the audio and get us affidavits, people who have firsthand knowledge, either were in the courtroom, heard things at the ranch, you know, at the your residence or place of business where they did the raid and what they did. Anyone involved in the family, anybody, as many affidavits as you can get. Get us that also the copy of the judge's instructions. How long was it in the court for? How many days did the case go for?
He was in trial for 3 days.
3 days. If you can get the audio on all 3 days, or even whatever in writing, it doesn't matter. That would be helpful also. Transcripts. That would be helpful. So we need the preferably the audio, but we'll live with the transcripts also. And the affidavits, and we will take this into our case, and we'll make this one of our spearhead cases. This is one that we'll kind of really make a big point about. You know, we got a few cases that are going in that are very strong, powerful cases where really a lot of abuse took place, and this sounds like one of those kind of cases also. So, who have you been talking to, Gerard or Jan or? Who have you been talking to?
Alan.
Who?
A guy by the name of Alan from North Carolina.
Alan. From North Carolina. Yeah.
Okay, well, what you need to do is get in touch with Jan or Gerard. I don't know. Gerard, you want to handle this?
Yeah, I can. I just we'll get his contact information. He can.
Do you have his contact? You got his phone number? Okay.
I have two phone numbers.
Gerard will call you up and start a communications with you, try to get whatever evidence we can together, whether we can get the audio tapes, which is the best, or even both, the transcripts and the audio case, but either or both. Affidavits, you know, you just told the story exactly how you told it. The only thing you were missing is you gave us dates too, so... You know, that's good. On or about a certain date, a certain time, this happened, that happened, the other thing happened, and this is where it went to, and so on and so forth. Just like you told that story, that's a perfect affidavit. Anything you want to add to it that gives us more detail of the violation of your rights and anybody else from any other point of view what they saw as a witness, that they can write an affidavit. And then once we gather all that information together, then we'll have a final meeting with you before we bring it into the case, into our case here in New York. Okay?
Yeah.
We'll need, I'd like to get the name of the judge, Gerard will go through this with you. We need the name of the judge. We'll need the court, the name of the court, the address, obviously, maybe we'll do a show cause to that judge. You know, this was a federal court, yeah, a federal case, I remember, yeah. Okay,
yeah,
so...
Yeah. Did they sentence him today or no? Where is he at with the case?
He's going to be sentenced, it's in June the 30th.
Oh, June the 30th.
Okay, so we have some time. That's good. If we move quick enough, we can maybe try to put some pressure on them concerning their sentencing.
I got a question. Would my father have to sign anything?
No, he doesn't.
Fine.
I mean, if he could do an affidavit, that'd be fine. But if he can't, that's okay. You know, there's enough witnesses. You can write all the affidavits.
Yeah.
Okay.
When the trial was, you know, he was convicted for 13 counts, and one was for not appearing in court. But he's a pro se. He doesn't have an attorney.
Yeah, but bear in mind, you know, this is once the whole thing is about abuse, everything else is irrelevant at that point. People do whatever they can do to protect themselves, to keep their freedom, and so on and so forth. And again, did he not show up because he wanted to keep his freedom?
Did he not show up because he didn't realize? He thought it was in a different court. He thought it was the same circuit of appeals.
So that
and he was not ordered. He was not ordered to be there.
That should be in someone's affidavit. If you have the knowledge of that, then you can put it in your affidavit. And just get all of these details in sworn affidavits, you know, just write them down and make all the notes and then swear to it. You know, we have to have a sworn affidavit in order to really put any power behind the case. And generally speaking, they don't have anything behind their case. I bet you they don't have any sworn affidavits or anything even from the federal FDA or anybody else in the federal government, I'll bet you. There's nothing there, I'll bet you. And you mentioned also there is no injured party. Nobody's been injured here. And so anyway, you get this together, and I suggest you move quickly because we'd like to do something before they actually come and make the determination concerning sentencing. Okay?
Yeah.
All right, Gerard, when do you think you might be able to call him?
Well, I could call him tomorrow sometime. I don't know. What time zone are you in? Is he in?
Eastern.
Eastern.
Eastern, so that's easy. You're on my time zone, so I can call you tomorrow during the day sometime if you're around.
Yeah.
And we'll do an initial call.
Period two.
Yeah, probably earlier rather than late.
All right, so you guys work
like
that out.
Get
as much detail as possible, as many affidavits as possible. Get the court record again, transcript or audio, and let's move on it. Okay.
Yeah, you need to set up a time now for August because. He uses a neighbor's phone, so we have to know when he'd be available.
Okay, Gerard, did
you
hear that?
To talk to you, Gerard.
I don't. So, what's good for you? Do you know that you can be available?
August
at a
uses
time?
A neighbor's phone. He uses a neighbor's phone, so he has to know when you're going to call, so he can be there.
Right.
Well,
August.
I'm flexible.
For Gerard to
what
call
about
you, August?
What about August? August. When can you get to the phone?
Any time after 1 o'clock tomorrow.
1 p.m.
Yeah, any time after 1 p.m.
Okay, so after in the afternoon. Okay, so you got that number right? I'll call you. I'll get a hold of you tomorrow, Jan, or later tonight or something. Okay.
All right. So what time do you want to call August? 2 o'clock.
Yeah, I'll be around. I'm probably going to be around 2, something like that.
Hey,
okay,
it won't be on
call this. You at 2 o'clock.
It won't be on this here number here.
No.
It's going to be, I'll be calling on the phone that you're going to be on.
Okay, you don't have that number, that's the number, neighbor's number.
What number does Jan, what number did you give Jan?
Yeah, the 2305 number you called in on tonight. Will that work tomorrow after
No,
one?
It would be a different number.
The 2819?
Yes.
Okay. I'll give him the 2819.
Okay, and then Gerard will share with you phone numbers. He'll give you his phone number and Jan's phone number, and then you can get back in touch with us if you have anything to talk about as we're going through this process of gathering information.
Hey, August, do you have access to a computer at all? Like for dropping files into Skype and stuff like that or no?
Yeah.
You do, okay, because that makes life easier.
Uh-huh.
If you could give me those files, I'll give you my information on Skype and that where you can drop information to me, okay?
Uh-huh. All right.
Rather than having to put it in the mail and wait for the mail to come and all that baloney, okay?
Yeah.
All right. So I look forward to hearing from you tomorrow afternoon. Okay, I'll call you.
Well, you're gonna call him, Gerard, right?
Yeah, I said I'll call him. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, August, he'll call you tomorrow at 2 p.m.
All right,
thanks, and we'll be talking soon also again. At some point in time, we'll have a meeting, and we'll talk some more on a private meeting once we gather all this information together, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else, Jan?
Nope. Robert had nothing tonight, and so he dropped off, so we're down to Brent and Gerard now.
Okay. All right, one more thing before we go forward. Again, we're desperately in need of money. We're always in need of money. You know, we're filing a lot of papers and serving papers and doing a lot of work here, getting papers into the court. And at some point, you're going to see a tremendous amount of things going up on our page very quickly. We've got a lot of stuff that we're going to file into the courts as evidence and start storing it in the courts and, of course, up on our website. And we do need money. Everything works on money, unfortunately, is the way it is. So we're asking everybody to give us $5 a month or more. Some people can afford $10 or $20 or whatever a month, but most people, almost everyone should be able to afford $5 a month. So please give us $5 a month and help support this work that we're doing. And again, if you have a case that you want to get into this court as far as giving us an affidavit, and it'll be dealt with at some point in time, but we have a lot of paperwork going in, and we're going to see. Right now, the big battle is up there in Washington with the Attorney General to make sure that he does the right thing. I have to say I don't have a lot of faith in this guy, but I have no reason to doubt that he won't do the right thing. I'm sure he knows what's going on, and I'd like to know what he thinks about our paperwork and what he thinks about all this abuse in the courts and what his position is going to be. We're going to find out shortly, I'm sure. But anyway, he's been put on notice concerning this problem, and the president has been copied, and others have been copied. We're going to push forward and see where we go with it. But okay, with that, let me move over to Brent. Brent Winters, the author of The Excellence in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic? But you're muted if you're talking.
Yeah, there I'm good. Thank you, John.
Again,
the only remedy for the lawlessness we see is law, true law. There is no other remedy. There is no other possibility. Never has been, never will be. History is replete with examples. And God says it that way. Well, one of the volumes of the expression of law that we take as Americans is organic. That means fundamental. Is the Declaration of 76. The Declaration of 76 always is printed with the Constitution of the United States. In most cases I've seen since I can remember, and it's been that way from what I read since the very beginning. They always occur together in printing. And the reason for that is that The Constitution of the United States is a rather dry and dispirited skeleton of words without real facts. The Constitution of the United States does not give us the facts of the case. And our common law is without life, without facts. We are a facts-oriented people because we are a common law country. We do not seek legal theory first. We seek facts first. We ask the jury, who done it? Why did he do it? Where did he do it? With what did he do it? We want the facts. Frankly, they're not interested in the details of the law, and the trouble with juries is, if there is a trouble, is that they throw away their independent judgment. I can't imagine, for example, in this case, putting a man away for however long they're putting him away, this case about the whatever, the milk and the salve that this fellow was selling. I can't believe that the jury would be willing to throw a man away from his family if they really trusted their own judgment about the case. But men are not independent-minded in our country. We do not have a critical mass of men that exercise independent judgment. There's too much dependency upon experts. Well, let's go to the Declaration of 76, and I'll stop pontificating. Paragraph 2, we left off here. I got distracted the last couple of weeks. Paragraph 2, the Declaration of 76. He starts out his argument, this is as it were a common law complaint. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is the fact, the facts upon which the entire inferences of the Declaration of 76 are based. It is impossible to use reason, logic. It's impossible to think. Let's just put it that way. It's impossible to think without accepting some fact to be true without proving it. And you start from there as a premise. If you do not accept some fact to be true without proving it, thinking is impossible among men. That's why he starts here, and he says we have self-evident truths. Self-evident, that means they need not be proven. We need not offer any evidence. They're self-evident. That means we need no evidence. It's so abundantly apparent, all men, and he's, of course, writing this so the world will read it, all men will take judicial notice. That's what the courts would say. Something so abundantly obvious, we needn't fight over it. I read a case once about judicial notice. The court was defining what it was because that was the question of the case, what is judicial notice? And the fellow that wrote the opinion said, as an example of what a court, of that which a court may take judicial notice, would be if it were raining outside the courtroom and they have big windows, if the judge could look out the window, and if he could see that it was thundering and lightning and raining, he would take judicial notice of that fact. Well, that's an obvious case, but still it makes a point. It makes the point that judicial notice is of those facts that need no proof. They are so abundantly apparent. The greatest exposition of the gospel in the Bible, the book of Romans, Paul the apostle writing to the Romans, he begins with a fact. It's a, by the way, the whole thing's reasoned out, the whole book. It's the one book in the Bible, it's in the New Testament, that was written as a piece of logic. And he begins with a self-evident fact. And he, there in chapter 1, he says, for the wrath of God is constantly being revealed continually from the skies, from heaven, against all ungodliness of men. That's a self-evident fact, he says. Look around you. Do you not see that the wrath of God is being revealed from the skies? Well, either Paul's right or he's wrong. I say he's right. I can see it. It doesn't take a lot of proof. Let's start with that as a premise, and then he moves on through the book and makes his arguments. And he, as a prosecuting lawyer, that's really what he's doing there. He's convicting everybody of their sin before he starts and gives the remedy. But that's self-evident, that the wrath of God is continually being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness of men. That means ungodliness, that means lawlessness. That's what it means exactly. Well, here he says the self-evident truth is that all men are created equal. I know well that it does not say that all men are equal. The fact of the matter is all men are not equal. Matter of fact, no man is equal to any other man. That is an absurd thing to say. I am not equal any more to other men, any more than apples equal oranges. Now, apples and oranges may have equal worth, and that's what this means here, equal worth. It does not mean we're equal. I probably said this last week, I do not equal Larry Bird. I can't play basketball like Larry. Well, Larry didn't play that well anymore, probably. He's getting older, but there was a time I could never play basketball like that. And the reason is because I do not equal Larry Bird. Matter of fact, every person is so unique. Well, you can't be so unique. Unique's not a comparative. Every person is unique, period. That means no member of Adam's race equals any other member. No member of Adam's race equals any other member. But every member of Adam's race is created of equal worth, equal standing before the law, equally important. And that's what this phrase means. By the way, all of this is lifted out of the Scottish Enlightenment by way of an Englishman by the name of John Locke, who was a great fan of the Scottish Enlightenment. And John Locke was a Puritan by understanding and training. He was a student of the greatest of Puritan teachers, John Owen. And he was a student of the Bible, wrote a commentary on the Bible, John Locke did. And he believed that all of God's standards of law came in two volumes, the laws of nature unwritten in the nature of things, and the laws of nature's God written in the Bible. Well, that's what this phrase, we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. The creator endows men. Endow, fancy word, means give. Dow. Dow means to give. It's an ancient root. Here's another ancient root. I wanted to bring this up. The word evident, is probably the oldest that we can trace, the oldest root in our language, evident, that we know about. I mean, there may be others that are older, but we can trace this one clear back to the Sanskrit, clear back to India and the Veda. And we get our word video from this word, video, and put the E on the front, and it's the aorist case, the general case.
Yeah.
But it's evident. That means, we get a word video, it means that which may be seen. Evidence is that which we see with our eyes, which we, of course, then also hear with our ears. Evidence is that which men, we're not God, we're men. So we have to have evidence to know what's true, to make up our minds about what is true, and God says that, the Creator himself, and he provides the evidence. And he says that, or this says here, that these are self-evident, these are seen. That's what this word means, and they're parsing the words here. Endowed means that these things are given in to men. God himself, the creator of heaven and earth, and all things that in them are, he made man, and he gave him certain rights that are unalienable. That means I cannot separate myself from my rights, and no other person can separate me from my rights either. It is impossible. I can't sell them. I can't get rid of them. That's what unalienable means. Some people say unalienable. Well, that's true, too. But that's not what this word stresses. They are not lienable. They cannot be put up for security. So they're not lienable. But these are rights. And the word rights is hackneyed in our tongue. It does not mean today to men that speak English what it meant even at the time this was penned. Today, rights, we tend to think they're something that we can use selfishly. Well, I want my rights, and I want to do what I want to do. And the whole libertarian, the lawless libertarianism comes in, and libertarianism is lawless if it's pure libertarianism. But I don't take that position. The writers of our Declaration didn't take that position. They took the position that God had given us rights. What are rights? And there's another old word that goes back in the Germanic tongue, Anglo-Saxons, a Germanic tongue. And the word still exists in German, and it became popular during World War II, and it got a negative connotation because Hitler and the Nazis called Germany the Third Reich. The Third Reich. And that's a word in the German tongue yesterday that has to do with law. And there are two words in the German tongue that have to do with law. One of them is Reich, and the other one speaks of a different, of law in general. But this word, Reicht, in the old German, Reicht, we say now, R-I-G-H-T. By the way, our common law, before it was called the common law, was called the Volkreicht. The Volkreicht. Volk is the folk or the people. It is the right of the people. What is the right? What does that German word mean? What it means is this. It means duty. Duty. Rights do not have corresponding responsibilities, as is often said. No. Rights are responsibilities. Rights, the Anglo-Saxon word for the Latin word, jurisdiction. Jurisdiction. If I have a right, that means with it's hard to use the word without, define the word without using it. If I have a certain jurisdiction, that means I have a right to act with respect to a certain matter. If a court has jurisdiction, it has a right to act respecting a certain matter. If I have jurisdiction in my business or my family, that means I have a right to act respecting a certain matter and to choose what actions are best to be taken within a scope. I can't just do any blasted thing I want. I must act within the scope of the delegation that God has given me. All authority. What is authority? It's right. What is right? It's jurisdiction. Those are synonyms. The Bible tells us, Romans chapter 13, again, Paul writing to those Romans, Romans 13, 1, all jurisdiction. Most translations, a lot of them say all power. It's not power, it's jurisdiction. All jurisdiction, which is right, comes from God. He is the ultimate fountain of all jurisdiction. And all right, jurisdiction, is delegated to men. And those rights that are delegated to men, the individual, direct from God without anything in between. We call those fundamental rights, unalienable fundamental rights. Now, I can have contract rights. A contract right is given because of men making agreements. That's not a fundamental right in this sense. I have the fundamental right to contract. Yes, that's true. God gave me that. But the rights that I create are something that I've been delegated the power to do, and then once I have, the other person has to participate. Once rights are redelegated after God has delegated them to somebody, I used to delegate to my children duties, rights. Now I'm going to be gone, and here's what I want you to do. I'd write it down. I'd say it. I'd pound it into their heads, and I'd say, I want this done when I come back. Or sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't, depending upon the circumstance. But I did delegate duties, and I've had duties delegated to me by other men. I've had all sorts of duties delegated. When you take that oath when you're a young serviceman, you're delegated duties. But those are not fundamental rights. Those are rights that are redelegated from men. Here we're talking about fundamental rights, most importantly. Number one, the right to life. What is life? It is a bundle of duties. That's what it is. It's a bundle of responsibilities. And it's a blessing, a joy to have those responsibilities, by the way, because if you have that kind of responsibility, you have discernment, you have the right to make decisions, you're a free man. And that's a blessing. And it's a joy. So life, liberty, and it says here the pursuit of happiness. Happiness. Now, that's kind of dubious in some people's book, this phrase, pursuit of happiness. As a matter of fact, we read that in the first draft of the Declaration, maybe the second one, I don't know, but at one point, it was life, liberty, and property, as our Constitution of the United States puts it. But it was changed to say pursuit of happiness. But I want to point out, as Tom Jefferson pointed out on many occasions, the one who finally drafted, the main drafter of the Declaration of 76, he said this, and he said it truly, it's true. He said rights and property are two words for the same thing. For this reason, we have rights in our property, and we have property in our rights. The words are interchangeable. Life and liberty are rights, and they are also property. And the pursuit of happiness is a right I have depending upon how you understand the word happiness. But to pursue happiness is to pursue, most fundamentally, and that's the way I take the word, blessedness. There's another old Anglo word, blessedness. It has to do with blood, but it has to do with the sanguinity, the blood of life. When your blood's up, you're happy. And that's what blessing means. And the pursuit of the blessings of God is what I believe is meant by this phrase. The blessings, to use this word here, of their creator. What are blessings? Use another word. They are the benefits of life. The curses are the burdens. The blessings are the benefits. That's been the use of those words throughout the use of our Anglo-Saxon tongue. So rights are duties. Men are created equal. Men are not equal. They have equal worth and standing before the law. And they're given, their creator has given to them at their creation certain rights that they can't get rid of, certain duties they can't get rid of. One more thing. If God, the creator himself, has delegated a duty, not indirectly, but directly to the individual, then those are the duties that are non-delegable. Now you say, why is that true, Brent? Well, I don't know all the answers to that, but I do know this, that it's always been that way in our common law tradition. And I have to believe, as Justice Joseph Story said, that there never has been a time that the faith that we call Christianity today has been called other things in the past. But there never has been a time that that faith did not lie at the foundation of our common law. So I take our common law in that context. There cannot be law without a lawgiver. And if the true lawgiver is anything less than the creator of heaven and earth and all that in them is, then life isn't going to be worth living, and I don't want that kind of law. I want law from a pure source. And if it's not from a pure source, it's not pure law. And if it's not pure law, it's no law at all. So that's what I think is important at this crisis moment of our country that we look to. We look back to the source, back to the fountain. That's what these men believed. If these men believed it, and they wrote it down, and they observed it in the nature of things, the laws of nature, that's what this is, our Declaration of 76, it's an observation of the laws of nature. The way things are, and they will not change, that there is a creator, and he has created all things, and we have nothing that we have not received from him, and that he has granted to us, by direct delegation, the responsibilities, the rights we call fundamental, then it should be our deepest drive to do what he wants us to do. And we get a good deal out of it. We get the opposite of what you see swirling about you now as a cesspool of lawlessness. It's always been bad, but it is true. I haven't seen it this bad in my lifetime. Well, the foregoing clause, this entire clause here, this is the opening of paragraph 2, forms one sentence, what I've read here. And it recites five self-evident truths, five, from which the colonists in America reasoned in arriving at their conclusion to separate from the country called Britain and to declare their dependence, not their independence, their dependence upon the Creator, the judge, the supreme judge of all the world. Now, each of these five self-evident truths listed are so well known they don't need any proof. But each five of them is set off from the one before it by the word that, THAT. The way of our common law tradition and of the Bible, the two volumes, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, the way of it is to begin not with legal theory or legislation, but with facts that are beyond dispute, beyond any dispute. And that's why it begins that way. Well, the secret to true happiness is liberty. True happiness is happiness. That means you stay happy. That means you have the happiness of benefit, of blessing, of keeping your blood alive, of life. And how to have that is liberty. Life is pleasant if a man knows he's free. Free to do what he ought to do. That's what freedom is. Freedom is not the freedom to do whatever you want to do. No, not at all. It won't work. It brings bondage. Freedom is freedom. God frees men, the creator of all things, to do what they ought to do what he desires them to do.
And that's why he gives us law. Our greatest blessing is his will, his law, the revelation of his will to us. Liberty wells up only from the heart. That means the core of life. The French call it cœur. And they extend it and they have the word courage, that which wells up from the center. If you're free, you have courage. If you are not free, you do not. You fawn. And you tremble at the rustling of a leaf. You're afraid of everything. From time out of memory, only the one having been given authority, that is rights, has also the power to take those rights back. Not having been given, I said that wrong, having given it. He who has the power to give has the power to take. And only the creator can take your fundamental rights from you because they were delegated by God himself. He can take them if he wants. He can take your life if he wants. He gave it. And he is of right, only the only one that has the right to take it. And that's why, of course, the written revelation of God's will, the oldest book of the Bible, probably the oldest, we have pretty good evidence of that, the book of Job. Job said this when God allowed some of what he had to be taken away, quite a bit as a matter of fact. He declared this, the Lord gave, then the Lord took. The Lord gave, the Lord took. Job 1:21. He was acknowledging that fundamental principle of law that always has been and always will be. Only he who has the right to give and does give has the right to take. So also our declaration here declares that those in government can never separate the individual from the fundamental right that God has delegated direct to him. No man granted them. They're God-delegated responsibilities. No man can take them away. You can't even sell them or get rid of them yourself. That's why I say, even though a man may, as a practical matter, have his be in bondage, in reality, he hasn't lost any of his rights. And he'll answer for them, even if he's driven in the eyes of men into bondage. He'll still answer to God for the use of what God has given him. Personhood and these rights, God, these fundamental rights God gives by direct delegation, are inextricably entwined together. And any person, whether in government or out of government, refusing to recognize or otherwise trespassing upon another's fundamental right, does a personal offense against the Creator who has bestowed the right. To trespass against the rights of another, these are fundamental duties that God has given other people. Jurisdiction, his exclusive right to act. To trespass on that is to fly into the face of the Creator. And there will be a consequence to pay. It happens a lot. When we talk about government employees doing that, they do that. But ask yourself this question. Have you done that? Have you ever stood in the way of another man's right to make a decision concerning his children? Concerning his job, concerning his property? Have you trespassed upon his property? Have you discouraged? Here's a good one. I've seen this. Have you discouraged? Not a good one. It's a bad one, but it's a good example. Have you ever discouraged or seen someone else discourage a child, whether a child is small or grown, to disrespect parents? If you have, you have interfered. You have interfered with that person's exercise of a fundamental duty that God has directly delegated to that person. And that's what breaks down our country, that kind of behavior. Do not interfere. If you know that God has delegated the right, do not interfere. Now, I know there are exceptions to that rule. If a man or a woman becomes lawless, there comes a time that interference can be a duty, not an option, a duty. I understand that. But as long as a man and a woman or a child is within the scope of authority God has given them, other men, other women need to stay out. And that means do not discourage them away from their duty. That takes a little bit of contemplation, takes a little bit of attention. Well, that's what God wants us to do. He wants us to do what he wants us to do. He does not want us to interfere with duties he's given others. He gave those duties to others. Another good example, education of children.
You cannot redelegate that duty called your duty to educate your children. It's impossible. That's a fundamental duty given to you. God, the Creator, gave you children. And along with that becomes, and same thing's true with spouses, becomes a fundamental duty to educate your children. If you send your children away to somebody else to educate them, that's okay if you think you ought to do that. But remember, that other person will not answer to God ultimately for the education of your child. You will answer. And if you send your children away to school in California and they decide they want to pump them full of vaccinations from the Merck company that's full of mercury, I find that fascinating, the pharmaceutical company that puts most of the mercury into vaccinations. Quicksilver, that's what it is. The name of the company is Merck. I haven't looked that up, but it's true. But if you do that, you're responsible. If Merck goes into the child and the child then has autism, which is the result often of that, then the parent who has delegated the duty of the care of the child is responsible. Every person has jurisdiction. Here's an easy one. Every person has jurisdiction over their home. A man's home is his castle, as the old common law castle doctrine puts it. And no one else has the right, the jurisdiction, to bust in without proper authority. We just heard a story about an Amishman. They busted into their curtilage. I didn't hear the whole story, but I know they at least got into their curtilage, but I got the impression they got into their home, their curtilage, the outbuildings, and around their home, the property. Did they have a warrant? And if they had a warrant, was it truly lawful? Was it truly to do a lawful thing? Did it particularly describe the place to be searched and the things to be seized? Those are concepts, ideals of our common law that our Constitution repeats, that we somehow as a people don't insist upon like we used to. Is it our fault that government agents toss houses without warrants, seize people and beat them up and hold them at gunpoint? I've seen it all with my own eyes. I've been there when it happened. And this fellow just told a story of what happened to his family. This is the United States. Now, in South America and the rest of Europe and all over Asia, that's to be expected and has been for several centuries. They don't give it a thought. But we have different sensibilities here in a common law country. We're not like France and Germany and the rest of the Western world that way, or the Eastern world. I hope we don't get that way. But that's a good example. Again, there's a duty when God gives a person a home, whether married or not. They got a home, place to live, they're responsible for what crosses the threshold of that door. And they're not going to be able to say, well, somebody else told me it was okay, my professor told me it was okay, or the Pope said it was okay, or my preacher said it was okay, or the priest said it was okay. No, you can't redelegate those duties. They're the ones that come direct from God. They're yours, and that ends the matter, and you'll answer for them, even if you redelegate them. But if you think that it has to be done, somebody's a better expert than you, you really believe that, that's different. But still, you'll answer for the duty that God has given you. I believe I'll quit there, John. I've talked enough. I could have finished that section, but we'll go to the next sentence next time. Thanks again.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. Appreciate it. Okay, we're going to open for questions. Let's see, we got the Q&A on already. Anybody wants to get into the QA, star 6 to get into the Q. First person, let's see, is Jeremiah from California. Go ahead. Jeremiah, California. You're unmuted.
Hey, what's up? Am I unmuted?
We can hear you.
Okay. I apologize. Can you take my question in a little bit? I'm not ready for my question. Oh, actually, I just remembered now. Now, you know what it is? This guy who you have talking right now, Brent Winters, he says so many things that are relevant. I have to, I'm pulling files. I feel like I'm getting an upload, you know, out of the matrix. You know, I'm like, okay. And then I have to stop and think about what I want to say. But so that's excellent. Thank you, Brent.
Well, thanks for calling, Jeremiah. Did you want to ask a question, or did you
You want to make a comment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was my prelude.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay, go ahead.
So can you give me some background on the alcohol prohibition in this country? And the reason why I'm asking for this background is because it dawned on me recently that in Islam, you know, it's drinking alcohol is strictly forbidden. And I was wondering if the prohibition of alcohol in this country was evidence to that would lead a reasonable person to believe that quite possibly there was something corrupt going on within the government.
Something corrupt that led people to put prohibition in place? Is that what you're asking?
Prohibition of alcohol.
I think he's looking to see some history on it. I don't have any specific history concerning. I don't know if what you're looking for, Jeremiah?
Have you also
to go forward?
Yeah, John, have you also heard, though, that they prohibit alcohol consumption in Islam?
Well, no, I haven't heard that. I just did hear that. You
haven't?
Said it. But
I said it. Now, that's why I'm... Yeah.
Well, it doesn't surprise me, but I can tell you that, of course, you know, they have no authority to prevent people from drinking alcohol or smoking pot or do whatever it is they think they want to be doing. We need to be just teaching our children and even getting into the schools the fact that these things are damaging. But people are responsible for their own morality. And sometimes people can use these things and responsibly and not abuse them, and that's their business.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's what makes this a Christian country. I believe that it's important for everyone to take responsibility. Go ahead, Brent.
Well, I was just going to make the comment. It's a good example. Prohibition is a good example of governments of men leaving the jurisdiction that God gave them, going beyond the scope of the jurisdiction that God gave them of government, and making unlawful or claiming to make unlawful things that God never made unlawful. God never, ever makes alcohol unlawful. He talks, the revelation of God tells us that alcohol is dangerous, its abuse is stupid. It gives instances of the abuse of it and what it can do to you. But it doesn't outlaw it. It doesn't put that within the jurisdiction of the governments of men any more than it puts marijuana in the jurisdiction of the governments of men. And the whole movement of prohibition was an evil movement with a Christian cloak around it, of Christian women and the men that followed them, and screamed and hollered about men drinking. I think of Carrie Nation. She was probably the most famous, a woman of 6 feet stature, broad-shouldered and made a name for herself passing through the old cow towns along the old railroad in southern Kansas from one end to the other, throwing billiard balls through tavern windows with a hatchet in one hand and the billiard balls in another, then coming inside and busting the place up. But nobody dared touch her. She was the kind of gal you wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley. Well, it was all a show. It was ridiculous. It was stupid. She ended up making money later at New York on stage, made a name for herself doing that. And then people were foolish enough to go along with it, and that is why, by the way, in large measure, we have the FBI, the CIA, all the alphabet soup law enforcement agencies that we now have grew and got their good start during Prohibition as an excuse then to... And, of course, the other thing that Prohibition did, it destroyed the power of the state in many ways, and that was eclipsed by the FBI and people like Hoover, upstarts, that wanted to federalize law. Now a criminal law in America has been federalized. The states don't have much swing, doesn't seem like. There are almost 6,000 federal crimes on the books. This all rose out of Prohibition, and that's how it really got going. Then the drug outlawing marijuana, which came along later, gave the bureaucracies a deeper foothold. And we're suffering from all that now. Our prisons are full. We're building federal prisons. There were no federal prisons until, really, I think there was only one, maybe. Most all prisons were
army barracks or navy yards. Before that, people committed. There are only four kinds of crimes. The Constitution gives the federal government, the general government in Washington, D.C., jurisdiction over. And those four kinds of crimes are treason against the United States, not against the states, that's another matter, but treason against the United States, counterfeiting the current coin and securities of the United States, violations of international law, that's number three, and number four is piracies and felonies committed on the high seas. I mean, the feds didn't even have jurisdiction over pirates unless they were beyond the territorial waters on the high seas. That's what our
you know what, Brent?
Says. What's that?
Brent, I hate to interrupt you because you are so brilliant. But we're moving a bit off of my question, so I would like to ask another question now, because I think you did a good job answering that. But thank you, John. And everyone on the call, thank you for listening. Again, Jeremiah here from Northern California right now. But my question is about due process and whether or not it is more or less of a civil law feature or a common law feature, because when you're thinking, when I think process, I think structure, right? Due process means there must be a structure to me getting my remedy in some way or shape or form, if there's a guarantee for me, right?
Uh-huh.
So I believe that due process is a civil feature. And what's your belief there? Brent or Gerard or John, anyone. Thank you.
Well, I'll respond, then I'll let them say something just real quick. Due process is a common law feature, and process doesn't matter. There's only two kinds. Those that have listened to me often, you say, Brent, you're repeating yourself, but I keep saying it because it's worth saying it. And people may be listening that haven't been on before. But among the chief features of difference between the law of the land and the law of the city is that the law of the land, our common law, by whatever name we've called it through the centuries, is a process-oriented tradition of religion, law, and government. The law of the city is a result-oriented tradition of religion, law, and government. That means that in the law of the city, which is bureaucratic law, admiralty law, martial law, it's fundamentally a martial law but has different labels, the chief idea is we've got to achieve the result that the powers that be say we have to achieve. We're result-oriented. The statute says this, we got to get there. And when you have a tradition like that, it's the only tradition that there is, besides the common law tradition. When you have a tradition like that, all the world pretty near is under that tradition, under the Code of Justinian. When you have that, the ends justifies the means, and hence the well-known motto of the Jesuit order. The ends justifies the means. It doesn't make any difference how lawless you are to get there. And by the way, Islam, in the same way, lives by that code. Islam lives by that code that the ends justifies the means, and they are fundamentally law of the city, fundamentally Babylonian. And that's the great danger. There is no freedom like that. Then process doesn't matter. Use it if it looks good, and you can get it if you think you can make it work, but you've got to try these men, as Mussolini said, try them and have them shot. You go through the charade, but we got to reach the result of my command. I want these men shot. And that's not a small matter, and it really is that way in South America, and it really is that way in China, and it really is that way in France and Norway and Sweden and all the places where the Roman law has now taken hold. But in our common law country, we say, no, we're going to look down, we're going to stay the course. We're going to be process-oriented. We're going to follow.
But do we have trials?
Due and owing to all persons involved. It is the process that we must focus on, and this is, well, just a minute, let me finish this and then you can make comment. And this is also the truth of the way God in his written revelation of his will sets things up. It is the process that governs everything. That's why he says throughout the Bible, and the Old Testament says it over and over and over again, do not be afraid of the face of any man, speaking to jurors and judges. Do not be afraid of them, because the judgment is mine. Well, why does he say the judgment's mine? Because if you follow my process, the result is not your responsibility. You just cookbook it. Follow the process. And when you follow the due process, that means trial by jury is part of due process, the right to be heard, the right to get notice, and a reasonable and a meaningful and a genuine opportunity to be heard. That's due process. You don't get that, no process, the result's no good. That's the motto of our common law. So that's the grand difference. One is result-oriented, and the other is process-oriented, and there is no other option in life.
I hear you. Now, that makes a lot of sense.
Let me just respond real quick.
Okay, come on in. Yeah, please do.
Amen to that, Brent. I think the simplest way that I look at it is due process is the right to be heard in a court of justice, period. And that is what due process ultimately is, in my opinion, anyway. But go ahead. Give us your final thoughts there, Jeremy.
Well,
we're going to move on.
Okay. Well, no, thank you, John. I was hoping to get Gerard's on that. As well, but
you said
it's the right to be heard. Hold on, let me say something quickly, Gerard, before you jump in, because this is my last statement here. And thank you, Gerard. That a second ago I heard Brent mention that he said something about trying somebody, right? Try that person and then put them to death or something, he said. And so what comes to mind is juries. The only trier of fact in America is juries, and
in criminal cases, period. That's
but
it.
My point, that's a common law. That's common law. But he was attributing it to a civil law feature, and that's why I feel like he was saying something that was conflicted. If you go back and listen to the recording, I think you'll agree. But it's a deep concept. It's a deep subject matter. So I don't expect everyone to really be able to like quantify. The parameters within
Mussolini's thought on it. He wasn't saying that's the way it's supposed to be. He was saying that trial that Mussolini gave was a charade. It wasn't really a trial. In other words, try them and then kill them because the end justifies the means. We don't care if they're innocent or guilty.
Okay.
We just want to get to the results, which is what happens today because they have to show that they're working and a conclusion to arrest somebody and punish somebody because that's their process. They're process-oriented. They don't care who's innocent or guilty. They just have to collect the money, and they have to show that they're working.
Well, that's why it's confusing, Gerard, about this due process. That's why I feel like due process is more
but
of a Brent civil feature. Let me finish my sentence. Hold on. One thing, and then I'll shut up. I'm going to mute myself out. It's this. You can't have due process in a common law society because you have to be result-oriented in common law, period. That's why you see what you see in Venezuela with people burning people in the streets with tires and stuff like that because that's common law.
Well, I think you must have a misunderstanding of the word due process.
All right. Okay.
That's all I can think of.
Thank you.
Due process ultimately is the right to be heard. In a court of justice, ultimately, and a court of justice is one that has a tribunal in it that gets to decide innocence or guilt on a criminal matter, and or an injury or something of that nature. If any injury upon another person is an assault upon them, and of course intent has everything to do with that. And of course there's accidents and so on. But the bottom line is the people, which is the tribunal, makes the decision. And a court of justice is one that operates under justice. The meaning of justice, ultimately is godliness. So we're looking for truth. We're looking for a conclusion. Okay, that's what a court of justice is all about, and the right to be heard in that court. To get to that conclusion, that's the key.
But I think I don't know is a good way to be. You see, sometimes you just have to go with the I don't know mentality. I don't know what's going to happen, or I don't know, what happened, because you don't have all the facts.
That's exactly what we don't want. We don't want an I don't know. Look at maxims of laws kill the I don't know. When you start getting into I don't know, like what is the color of is, that's where you get lost. Look at men. Cannot enforce free will. That's where we get in trouble. That's God's part. You know what I mean? Let me ask you the consequences of what you do.
Let's look at the Bundy case. Let's look at the Bundy case. Well, let's look particularly out west in the wildlife preserve case, where the judge constantly kept shutting down all the witnesses. They did not. They did not give them the opportunity to be heard, because if the judge would have permitted that, the jury would have went overwhelmingly onto the other side of the thing, which they ended up on the right side anyway. But nevertheless, the judge did everything they could to prevent the people from being heard. You see, the people have a right to be heard in a court. That's due process. In a court of justice, a place where the people, the tribunal, are going to make a decision after they've taken an oath to do the right thing.
Right. Well, I believe what you're saying is that the courts had a duty to actually give those people that right. The people didn't have the right. Those guys that did what they did in Oregon, which I wrote a song about, by the way, and if you want me, you can email me at secondsonofdonald@gmail.com, and I'll give you the copy. But if you actually go and think about what happened, those people that made that decision, they didn't actually I lost my train of thought, but you understand where I'm going with this. The bottom line is that those people in Oregon had the right to do what they were doing regardless. You brought up Oregon, and I was thinking about that earlier.
The most important part of that whole thing had the right to tell their story. Okay, they had the right to come into that courtroom and speak, and they were muzzled. They were even the people who were the actual being accused of things were muzzled. The witnesses they tried to bring in were muzzled. Everything they tried to get going in that courtroom was muzzled. Okay, they have a right to be heard. You see, the judge can't control the heart of the jury as long as the jury is a free jury. That's the other second part of this problem. That was also a puppet jury, and they lost control of that puppet jury, didn't they? Because the jury went the other direction. They realized what was going on. They realized the whole thing was a sham. They saw they were being suckered. They saw a spy among them. I mean, look at the government. They just didn't stop. There was no way the jury could end up with anything other than to dismiss that case.
Why do you think in August's trial it took the judge the better part of an hour to give the jury their instructions? Because he had to speak in circles to bring them around to the way of thinking that he wanted them to think. It doesn't take an hour or 45 minutes to give jury instructions unless you're trying to brainwash them into thinking the way that you want them to think. It's a simple process. You listen to the facts, and then you run your heart. The fact that he hadn't talked to them for almost an hour means that he tampered with them. That's why. That's what these judges are doing.
Amen.
That's right.
Well, look at the history.
Part of it.
Yes, yes. Let me confirm what you're saying, and then I'm gone. You can take the next caller.
Yeah, we got to go to the next caller.
The way you can confirm, that there is no due process is that basically they don't give it. They don't actually give due process to you or to me, to private individuals, because it doesn't apply to you or to me. None of the Constitution actually applies to you or me. That's why they don't give it. The Constitution applies to agents of the government.
Well, that may be
I'm out of here.
Sick interpretation. Okay, appreciate it. Thank you. That may be their sick interpretation. It certainly isn't anybody with common senses.
They're not under the Constitution because they're under an association, so it does apply. They just don't use it because they think they're above it. That's the problem.
They're all criminals. They belong in jail.
That's right. They're in a separate. It's like another. It's like another entity. What do you call that? Dimension. They're in a different dimension than we are, and they want us to operate in their dimension. And ultimately, they trick us into their dimension. So
Either
they know what the Constitution is. They don't want to mention it because they know that they're not under it. And they don't want to admit that. That's the part they don't want to tell you, that they're under a corporate charter. They're not going to tell you that. And therein is the problem. Anyway, we got to get to the next guy here.
Yep,
I'll shut up.
Let's go to the next person. Williams, 913. Missouri. Asulu. I don't know what that is, how to pronounce that name. Williams, 913. You've been unmuted. 913-702 from Missouri.
We put him to sleep. See
that? Okay, we'll go to the next person then. Last call for 913-702. Eric, go right ahead, VoIP dialer.
Hey, it's Eric.
How you doing,
in
Eric?
Georgia. Good, how are you?
Good.
Announcement. Don't have a courtroom, but this didn't get through to our courtroom observer, the person running that, I believe, because I never saw a notice for it. And the person who made the request never got a return message. So there is no courtroom number. The information is tomorrow, Tuesday, the 23rd of May, 10 a.m., Newcastle, in Wilmington, Delaware, Newcastle County, 824 Market Street. Again, that's Wilmington, Delaware, 19801. And this is at 10 a.m. tomorrow. This is for a woman, Dr. Kalahar, who's having a couple of properties non-judicially foreclosed. So if anyone can please make it tomorrow. Again, don't have the courtroom number, but you can probably figure it out with the name of Dr. Kalahar, C-O-L-A-H-A-R, Kalahar. 10 a.m. tomorrow, Newcastle County, 824 Market Street, Wilmington, Delaware, 19801. And thank you. Mussolini's was result-oriented, not process-oriented. Again, due process is process-oriented. And a good example of what happens when something is result-oriented is what we see with this thing called the Innocence Project. And I don't know if you've heard of this, but I think there's pretty much there's one in almost every state of the union now. And it's this thing where these attorneys go around and they try to get people out of prison or off death row who weren't innocent and or who weren't guilty. They were innocent, and the facts didn't prove that they were guilty. And I mean, there's thousands of people that they've gotten out of jail with this Innocence Project. And this is a classic example of what happens when we don't use due process, because the attorneys, whether they're the defendant, the defender's attorney or the prosecutor or the judge, they don't give a care about process. All they want is what they want. And so we have this thing called the Innocence Project now, because thousands upon thousands of people get railroaded all the time. So there's a good example of the difference between the two. If you follow due process, like Brent says, the facts, if you have the facts in your hands, the law is a foregone conclusion. It will be self-evident what the law is. We don't need any legislation for it. So anyway, I just wanted to make that little example there.
Well, that's a very,
but it's really not hard to understand. No, thank you. It's not hard to understand at all. It's real, real simple. So I don't understand the confusion, other than maybe you don't, it's just something you don't want to see.
I think a lot of people get confused because of statutes and codes and ordinances and the fact that they're beat up in courts over these things. They're being, you know, they're being treated as if they're run under, they're controlled by a corporate control power. I mean, ultimately, that's really the bottom line.
Look,
I mean, the policies and procedures, you know, are written down to control the people who work for a corporation or are under the veil of the corporation, and to make things work the way the will of the corporation wants to go. And ultimately, that's exactly where we're at, because we're up against corporate America, who controls our courts, ultimately, and special interest groups, you know, that control our courts also, which again gets back to, you know, corporate America again. So again, these problems, it's just the same. Edward.
I'm going to give you a real-life example of the robotrons that these judges and courts have become. I had a customer that came in to me. I was inspecting his car. It was overdue. He got a ticket in the airport, and he had been over in Europe, and the inspection sticker ran out while he was here. So he was trying to drive the car out of the airport, and he got a real testy cop who gave him a ticket and said, I can impound your automobile and all this stuff. And so later on, when he was going to plead the ticket, he says, I'm going to plead the ticket innocent because, you know, I was driving the car from the airport and the inspection sticker run out. I had no, I was on my way up to my mechanic to get it inspected. And she, and he says, I'm going to appeal it. And the judge says to him, there's no appeal of that. She was slapped. That's not an appealable offense. So an inspection sticker is a very statutory thing. You either did it or you didn't, and there's no excuse of why, you know what I'm saying? There's no discretion in that judge's mind of why you would drive a car with no inspection sticker ticket. I mean, that was a perfect opportunity to say to that judge, well, let me ask you something, Your Honor. If somebody was bleeding to death and you had a car with no inspection sticker on it, but you could put them in there and get them to the hospital and save their life, would that not be an excusable offense, Your Honor? You see, they're Robotrons. They can't even get there. There is no appeal on that charge. Totally beyond this judge's mind of how you could possibly appeal that offense because it's strictly statutory. Either did it or you didn't. Was the sticker run out? Yes. Were you driving it? Yes. We don't need to know anything else. You see how they are? They're the Borg.
Yes.
Resistance is futile. Yes. They're machines. Yes, the Borg, they're Automat.
Right.
Anyway,
you,
that's
you
what
used,
you're up against.
You used a great term. Gerard or John called it a psychological disorder. You called it a, I think you said, I really liked it, a cauterized perspective. And John's right, it is a psychological disorder. But because, like John says, it cost them so much money to get this degree and there's all this money flowing back and forth and, you know, and of course, all the mammon worshipers, they love money and that really means something. Elevates your status. It's an artificial elevation. So, yeah, I see what you're saying. It is a cauterized perspective, as you described. I don't know where you got those words, but those are really spot on. Yeah, it's what we're up against. It's really difficult.
Those are mine original. I get an original.
I like the Borg better. The Borg.
Those I borrowed from Star Trek. Thank you very much.
Yeah, cauterized perspective. That's excellent. And then I guess just real quick, Brent, and I appreciate all that, thank you. And Brent had talked about, I don't know if it was Justice Joseph Story or another justice, but he was saying, I think it was, I don't know which one, but he was saying that he taught people how to write legal papers, write actions, I think, whereas before you had to really spend time and get an experienced a lawyer to help you with that. And this was an artificial barrier. And after this fellow, this justice, wrote this book, they made it a lot more difficult to pass the bar. And so this was another artificial barrier to getting into the courtroom. And I just wanted to say that I understand the artificial barriers because you don't want, I guess, anyone just coming in there willy-nilly and wasting the court's time. However, these artificial barriers rub me the wrong way because I believe the cream of the crop will rise to the top anyway. But then the downside of having these artificial barriers, such as the bar today, what we see is that people don't want to spend this time learning all this stuff that the bar teaches, and we find out in common law that it's all bunk anyway. It's all garbage. They come out with a cauterized perspective, a psychological disorder. They don't know the truth anymore. And then also you have this triangle of treason, as I like to call it, where the prosecutor and the defender's attorney form the base of the triangle and the judge forms the head and or the point of the triangle, and you pay to be considered fourth in line. And so the downside of this, I mean, I was just talking to a woman recently who told me her attorney got her to sign this paperwork that removed any of her ability to do anything for herself or to defend herself. And she was sickly. She was bedridden. She didn't understand the language, used some term like engorgement or something, and she didn't get it. And her attorney later on said, the reason I threaten you with this, he gave some haphazard excuse. Anyway, my point is this artificial barrier has really turned into something disgusting, despicable, and ugly, and it's unjust. And anyway, I wonder if Brent has anything to say about that, because I appreciate the need for an artificial barrier, but at the same time, I believe that the cream of the crop would rise to the top anyway, and I wonder if Brent understands what I'm getting after here.
Oh, I do.
Brent, before you answered, today they said this new justice that Trump put in has changed the litmus test for what gets into the Supreme Court. I don't know what's changed about it, and I don't know if you've heard that, but I think it goes hand in hand with what he just asked you about. So I don't know if you know anything on that.
I hadn't heard that, Gerard, but I'm going to look. Now that you mentioned, I get on the internet and find it, no doubt. I'm not keeping up with everything. But to say something,
hold on. Let me unmute. I'm going to unmute Fred from California because I think he was talking about that. But before we do that, let's let Brent answer Eric, and then I'm going to unmute Fred meanwhile. Brent, respond to Eric.
Just to make a mention about Justice Story, when he did that, the barrier in Massachusetts, and that's where he was at the time, to the practice of law, was the ability to write pleadings the way the court would accept them. And if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned this maybe last week, there have always been barriers to the practice of law ever since the bar came about back in the 13th century. And it came about, the reason there has been barriers, it came down to two things. The Norman invasion of England, the Norman invasion were the Normans that lived along the coast of France. They were Norwegians by blood, but they lived there about 165 years, and they claimed right at the throne of England and invaded at Hastings on the south end of the island and defeated the Anglo-Saxons. There were only about 6,000 of them when they invaded. Big battle, day-long battle. They won by a quirk. Somebody shot an arrow at a venture and hit the King of England in the eye. And once word got out that he was hit and good as dead, they lost heart. They'd had 2 weeks of hard fighting up north and then down south, and they faltered at the last charge. But there were 6,000 of them, and there were probably 800,000 Anglo-Saxon in England. The Anglo-Saxons spoke Anglo-Saxon. The Normans spoke a bastardized French called Norman French. Well, they were in charge. The 6,000 were in charge of the 800,000. And they set up the courts, and they put Roman priests in the common law courts. William the Conqueror declared the common law was still in force, but they put Roman priests in to administer the courts. Well, the Roman priests knew nothing of common law standards. They were lawyers of the law of Rome. That's what a Roman priest is. He's a lawyer of the canon law. He knows little about the Bible unless he takes a extra interest in it. Some of them do, maybe, but ultimately it's the canon law that is their guide. And so they begin to use those principles in the courts. Well, within 150 years, the Anglo-Saxons, of course, they were kicked off anyway. They couldn't get in the courts because they couldn't speak the language that the courts used, which was Norman French. And if somebody wanted to get in the court that was Anglo-Saxon, they had to find somebody that could speak both languages so they could talk to the Saxon, or the Dane, Anglo-Dane-Saxon, talk to them in their Anglo-Dane tongue, and then talk to the court in Norman French. Well, that class of men arose that could do that. And in time, they were Anglo-Saxons usually, because they're the ones that cared about the Anglo-Saxons and were willing to learn both languages and go into court. Well, in time, they saw that they needed to if they were going to save their law, their way of life, their Volkreich, their common law tradition, which included the jury, by the way, and the Roman priests were pressing in on them. The history of England is about a jurisdictional fight between Rome and the common law. That's all it is. It's all it's ever been. Well, they formed themselves into a guild, and they wouldn't let them in the universities, Oxford, because Oxford was a product of Rome. All universities in Europe and all over the world are. The first one was set up in Bologna, Italy, with the declared purpose by the Pope of Rome, with the declared purpose of supplanting the Bible with the common law. That's what it was all about. And they were pushing the canon law, which is the law of Rome, the Code of Justinian, and they set up their own guild, so to speak, and they couldn't get in the universities to teach, so they even set up their own educational institutions to train common lawyers, lawyers of the common law, called in those days commoners. And the lawyers of the law of the city were called civilians. Civilians against commoners. And they wanted to educate the judges and keep them from using the Roman law in the courts. And these places of
learning were called Inns of Court, and the Inns of Court are still in England. At the founding of our country, right at 100 lawyers were in the American colonies that were graduates of the Inns of Court. And they were a lifelong, starting about age 14, training men in the forms of the common law. So that was the barrier. And even back in England, way back when we got to this country, we started our country, the barriers fell clear down. Anybody that wanted to practice law could. We had that popular kind of attitude, especially out on the frontier, but even in Massachusetts, the bar exam was the problem getting in. It was the pleadings. Well, by the time, for example, Abe Lincoln was practicing law in Illinois, there was the bar exam, not anything. I don't think there was one at all. Matter of fact, there wasn't. No, there wasn't a bar exam. But you had to know how to put the pleadings in. Well, when Justice Story did that, wrote that booklet on how to do pleadings so anybody could read it, he was young when he did it, he became persona non grata among the lawyers in Massachusetts because he allowed other men to hone in on their business. And that always develops that way, of course. A matter of money, it had happened in England. But in America, traditionally the barrier in the early days, even Indiana didn't have a bar exam to mount anything until the 1930s. It was part of our frontier experience that anybody who wanted to practice law could, but they still had to learn the forms. But you had to prove yourself wanting to do it enough to learn, and that took some hard work. Well, that's kind of the history of what's behind it. And then today, of course, the Bar Association, the American Bar Association, has become the gatekeeper because it's the one that accredits law schools. And it's nothing but a private organization. Anybody can join and wants to pay the dues. But they accredit the law schools, and that controls things quite a bit. As you've got to be a graduate in most, I think, every state now, as a practical matter, of a law school to practice law. Well, that's some of the history behind why the things are the way they are, why there is a bar association. I'll quit now. You can go ahead, John. You said there was
Let's get back to what was recently brought up concerning, I guess, this new justice made some kind of a statement. Fred, are you there? Fred from California? Because I unmuted you a little while ago. Can you hear me?
Thank you, by the way. Thank you.
Fred?
He
California Fred. I unmuted him.
I'm here. You just unmuted me.
Yep, go right ahead, Fred. You were bringing something up earlier concerning this new justice, and go right ahead.
Okay, first off, I want to make sure
The issue was brought up. That's why I'm pulling you into this call right now, but go ahead.
Sure, I understand. First thing I want to know is, do you have any feedback from me? Is my voice okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, because now I'm going to open up the other webpage to read it. Okay, this is USA News.
Okay.
And its title is Muslim Pissed Off, Pissed of Off at the Supreme Court's Decision. It's About Time. Excuse me. The full panel of U.S. Supreme Court justices consisted of 9 judges met today, and they finally made the fate-sealing decision of Islamic indoctrination in American public schools by the far left wing. Insane people that our educational system was infiltrated by after the Second World War. And now the decision that the Supreme Court made caused the Islamic indoctrination of the young in our nation to lose their mind. And here's where it's kind of important. Thanks to the tie-breaking vote made by Neil Gorsuch, the newly appointed Supreme Court nominee, the U.S. Supreme Court was able to hand out a decision banning Sharia law and Islam from being taught in classrooms. On the matter of Gorsuch stated, and here's a quote from Gorsuch, "The government certainly has no business being involved in religion. But this isn't a government issue or a religious issue. This is about the judicial branch interpreting the laws as they apply to the teaching of religion. We should be teaching any religions in this country besides standard Judeo-Christianity, as our founders wanted. And we certainly shouldn't be filling the children with lies about Islam being a religion of peace when they see the carnage on the news almost every day. It is our duty as Americans first and judges second to safeguard the way our children are indoctrinated.
Okay, that part that you just read, is that a quote by this new justice?
Yes.
Or is that the writer adding in his thoughts?
No, that was a quotation.
Okay. All right, so is that what we were talking about, Gerard? You mentioned something
about...
No.
Apparently what Gorsuch did also, and it's not in this article at all, is okay. The Supreme Court has a certain litmus test of cases that they will accept to bring them in. And he just rewrote those parameters. And we don't know if it's going to make it easier to get to the Supreme Court or harder. I haven't heard what they are. I just heard that they let him rewrite that, whatever that litmus test is, of cases that they will take to hear. He just rewrote it. Now, it could be good or it could be bad. I don't know what
it
is.
So we don't have a copy of that?
I don't. We should. Somebody should, you know, keep your eye out for it. I don't know, you know, how it's going to affect us, but it'll be very interesting to find out. You know, I mean, they're making a lot of changes. We've got to keep up with this stuff. But I heard that he rewrote it, and some people are not very happy with it, but I don't have the particulars.
Okay,
have to go,
Brent,
you know.
Haven't heard anything about this then, huh?
No, sir, not yet.
Okay. All right. Okay, let's move on. I'm gonna mute you again, Fred, but you're still in the queue. If you have another question, you'll be brought up in a short.
I did have a question.
Well, hang on for it. You've got two other people ahead of you, and we'll get to you in a minute, okay?
Yes, sir, no problem.
Just mute you for right now. Okay, let's see. Gerard, you want to take the cue, hit the next question? It looks like Alan from North Carolina. Do you want to take control of the cue here? Gerard, you there?
I'm talking into my mute.
You do that all the time.
I'm going to hit it. I hit it once.
Oh, my God.
I didn't do that.
What are you doing?
I didn't do anything. I hit North Carolina. I hit next question, and they all went away. They don't want to.
Well, let's get back to Q&A. Hold on. Okay, you guys are going to have to get back into Q&A, star 6, to get into queue. Okay, April is next. Do you have anybody that was in the queue, star 6, to get back into the queue? Okay, Gerard, you got it now?
Yeah, I'm going to try. I don't know. Here we go.
Next question. There you go.
There you go.
I'm going to mute out. I may pipe in here or there, but go ahead.
Yeah, I hit it right away. I wanted to make a comment about Eric brought up the Innocence Project, and yep. I don't want people to get false hopes. The Innocence Project only does cases that have DNA to prove your innocence. They will not do any other cases. And so there is not any places, with my son's case alone, 4 years now he's been in there. I've been fighting. I've been looking for someone to help me. And it wasn't until I found NLA that I actually feel like I have some hope. There is no place out there.
Yeah, by the way, April, just for a second, I think you are working on your affidavit, right? Because we're going to be getting your case into our case.
Yes, I am.
Okay. All right, go ahead. You get that. Okay.
I have searched for 4 years before I found out to find somebody to help me. Any place out there that is offering help for people, they're looking for $3,000 or more just to start helping on people's cases. They're not really looking to help. They're looking to make money. And the Innocence Project and other places out there that are saying that they're willing to help, they have stipulations for helping people. So they're not there to help the innocent. There's a lot of people in jail that I have spoken to, and they have gone all these routes, and so have I, and there's no help out there. And L.A. is the first place I found that has given a glimmer of hope to anybody that is innocent and convicted.
You know, based on this Innocence Project, they shouldn't even have an Innocence Project, because somebody should make a proclamation. If there's DNA evidence available that wasn't used in a case where somebody was convicted and it exonerates them, there should be no, yes. They should automatically be released. They shouldn't have to go jump through a bunch of hoops. The fact of the matter is that they convicted unfairly.
Here's what it says. What it says on the website: the Innocent Project does not review claims where DNA testing cannot prove innocence. We do not handle the following cases, and they have a whole list of cases they don't handle. So they're bullshit. They do not help.
The point is that if you have DNA that proves your innocence, you shouldn't need them. You have DNA that proves.
Yeah, well, there was DNA in my son's second case, and the DNA was there because he went to that store 3-4 times a week, and that's why the DNA was there. So a DNA doesn't mean squat. There was a guy that was in jail. He was older than me, this gentleman. He was a federal forensic expert. They put false charges on him and stuck him in jail over a year because he refused to plant evidence. So DNA means what?
It's a double-edged sword. That's right. They could use it for you or against you. Like you said.
In Virginia, right.
Just because your DNA is someplace doesn't mean you committed a crime, especially not if it's a place where you normally go anyway.
Well, Virginia is now doing something. Yeah, they are taking.
They should have thrown the DNA evidence out because he's there. He's touching things. So really, it's not a good evidence trail. You know, when they get evidence, they're supposed to show a trail that it was protected and that it couldn't have been, you know, changed. Well, when you're in a place, DNA is all over it. That means they should not be able to use DNA evidence against you.
Exactly. But right now, Virginia, I know this for a fact. Virginia is taking cold case files from 10, 15, and longer, 25 years ago. And if it has DNA there, they are prosecuting these people and convicting them just on the DNA. That's what they did to my son. The one the second case they put on him was because the prosecutor was pissed that the judge didn't give my son 50 years. He put a 13-year-old case on my son because he knew he was at that store. And they did the same thing. My ex-brother-in-law was a detective in that precinct, and he told my ex, point blank period, he had to arrest somebody that was an older gentleman. He was like 56 years old. He knew he didn't do the crime, but he had to arrest him anyway, and he was convicted.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah, they, it's a say-so state. That's what I call Virginia, the say-so state. You go to jail because they say so.
Yeah. Right. Well,
yeah.
Not pretty. And I yield.
Thank you very much, April. Okay, I'm going to go to Will. Will?
Yeah, Gerard. I think what you were referring to is the judges used to have the clerks read the cases and then refer them to the judges, and he did not join that group, and he insisted that the judges review the cases themselves to determine which ones they accepted, not the clerks.
Well, that sounds like a good thing to me.
Yeah, I think it is, because the clerks,
you know,
they can be bought off quite easily,
and
many other reasons.
The judge is the one that should have the discretion, not the clerk. I mean, you know,
right.
I don't know. Nobody wants to read anything in court. From our experience, I mean, look at the New York State Comptroller. The Attorney General. Knee-jerk reaction. You have no standing. We're going to answer for every governor, and we're going to throw you out of court. And we need 30 more days to answer. Excuse me, we didn't ask you to answer anything. And what's this knee-jerk reaction? You're going to answer for everybody and throw us out of court. So you just showed the people your true colors. You didn't read what the paper was about, and then you turn around and told us what you're going to do to us because we don't have standing, and you don't even know what the case is about. You know, to me, that was a perfect first response for them and a good chance for us to give them a black eye, which we did with our answer, you know, because that's what they do. They don't read anything. They just, you know, you're the people. You're coming in here against us. Guess what? You have no standing. That's their favorite thing. So I think the judges need to read. I think that's part of the problem. They don't want to read anything. Nobody wants to read anything. The attorneys certainly don't want to read. At least if the judges start reading, maybe the attorneys will start reading, because once the judge knows more about the case than the attorney does, then he's in trouble. They want to go in the back room and make a deal. That's what they want. I read a thing today. They said 97% of all federal cases are done by plea bargain, and I read this case where they railroaded this guy because they told him, if you don't take the plea bargain, it was a minor, stupid little charge that he was innocent of, but they blew it up into two 20-year sentences, and they said, we're going to make them run concurrently so that you have 40 years in jail. So either take the plea bargain, even though you believe you're innocent, or you're going to face 40 years in jail. They got to stop that plea bargain whole system, because that's what they're doing. They're bullying people and they're extorting them into taking plea bargains. Anyway, thank you for clearing up that Borchik thing. That's great. If that's what he did, I think that's a good thing. Is that it, Will?
Yes, sir. I yield.
Okay, thank you. We have...
Yep. You come down.
Why does it do that? I hit next question and Q&A goes off. Get back into queue, everybody. Star 6. Okay. Mr. Culpepper, you were up next. I'm going to unmute you. You go ahead.
Hi, Gerard. This is Terry from New Jersey.
Hey.
I was wondering if you had the opportunity to see 60 Minutes last night about a sheriff in Cook County, Illinois, named Tom Dart.
I hadn't seen it, no.
Oh, okay, because it was interesting, because he's kind of like doing things that the NLA would do. He's a former prosecutor, but, you know, he's trying to get the people in his jail help and, you know, psychiatric and financial. The warden of the jail is actually a psychologist who makes her rounds talking to the... inmates or prisoners or whatever you want to call them, to find out what their problems are and to help them, you know, adjust, you know, because they're going to get out eventually. Also with regard to money, too, I mean, he realizes that a lot of these people are stuck in there because they can't afford a few hundred dollars for their bail. And yet the state is paying thousands of dollars, you know, to keep them in there, and it makes no sense. So he's doing a pretty good job of trying to alleviate that situation. He also put a moratorium on evictions. Of course, the evictions were only for tenants and foreclosed properties. I'm sure you guys probably sent him the NLA papers. But if anybody's going to be open to it, this guy sounds like he would be.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. He puts a moratorium on evictions. That's great on foreclosed properties. They're gonna hate him because that's a big moneymaker for them. And I think at this point in time, with the stuff that the banks are doing, and the towns are doing, and the RICO and the fraud and the illegal deed conversions, they need to stop. They need to stop it right now before they put everybody out of their houses. So, you know, whoever the sheriff is, we should support him, and we should try to get more like him, because that shows that he's got a lot of boxy if he's willing to put it, saying that he will not enforce an eviction on a foreclosed property. That's pretty good stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like it to me. By the way, did you have a chance to see that video, American Patriot, about the Bundy trial?
Yeah, I do believe I watched that. Yeah.
What did you think about that? Do you have any thoughts on it?
Well, you know, there are so many factions out there, and it seems like we get distracted in things that don't make a difference when we should be doing more things that do make a difference. You know what I mean? I mean, we know they got these guys in jail illegally and that, and you know, I know that they're out there and they're marching around the jail and stuff, and that fills up some. Whatever you call them. But they really, really should be concentrating on the constitutional issues that's going on, because these people out there, they don't care. They don't care. You know, they look at the sheriff was nice to them in the beginning, and now she's telling them they got to go because they got a hold of her and they said cut it out. And who runs her county? It's the federal prison system that's pumping the money into the county. So they bring the sheriff right back into shape by threatening them that they'll pull the money out of the county. So, you know, my feeling is they should get on board with what we're doing and run those papers in there and go, you know, petition the judges and the wards and stuff to pay attention to this paperwork that's filed that they're not answering. You know, I mean, you could stand around the jail all day, but they got to know. They don't care about that. I mean, now they're going to chase them off the sidewalk. The first thing they do is put up with you for a little while, but they push harder and harder, and then they're going there and applying for permits, and are we okay to stand here and all this nice stuff? When, in the meantime, they haven't given them the first step of due process. That's what bugs me. And that's what they need to be, chanting about, their due process. The fact that there is no warrant, and there, you know, these things are not under the Constitution. I don't hear them, the patriots, yelling about that stuff. You know, I mean, I know there's some out there, but the thing is they gotta, you know, I mean, it's really good that they're sitting in the courts, but you see, when you sit in the courts, you got to sit there as an educated people, and the judges have got to know that you're gonna be saying that they need to be sanctioned because they're not following the Constitution, that they're committing treasons and crimes up there. If the judges know that the people know that, and they're going to make affidavits and they're going to bring charges on them, things would be different. They're not afraid of these people because they don't see any consequences for anything that they're doing. They could care less how many hours you sit in a cage out in front of the jail. It does. I'm not belittling it because it does bring some recognition to the local people. But people on the other side of the Mississippi are not even that far away. They don't even know anything's going on. They have no idea, you know. So you're building up a notoriety in the local area, but you're in a federal court, and you need to be more focused in your attack, and as far as letting them know that you're going to use that due process to go after these judges and these prosecutors that are doing the wrong thing. They could care how long you camp outside the prison. They don't care. That's my opinion. And Ammon's got some very good words. Look, we got to get his words out there. And why? Why aren't they doing the right thing? Who are these judges? And who are these people that are stopping this due process? Navarro. Everybody should be screaming about this judge, because she's that bad. That's my opinion anyway. I think they need to refocus where the problem is, and the problem is in the courts with the judges and the prosecutors and the due process that they're not giving them. And that's what they should be jumping up and down with banners screaming about, is no due process. Because they should have a booth They should be educating the people when they come. They should be giving them affidavit forms. They should be giving them busy things to do. Just standing there and camping out and screaming with a group of people that should be 10 times bigger than it is, and it's not, so it doesn't have any effect. You're wasting your time. You have to do, if you can get a couple hundred people to do busy things, like do affidavits and take paperwork and file complaints on these judges and put this stuff in the courts, get behind what NLA is doing, that's what's going to have an effect. They don't care if you freeze to death out in the street. They don't care. They're happy. They're glad. They're happy they made you do that. That's my opinion anyway.
Right. By the way, in that case with Tom Dart, the sheriff, that's actually, I forgot to add, is that he is the sheriff of Cook County, Illinois, which has been named the most corrupt county in the United States a couple of years ago, and probably hasn't gotten much better. But I don't know, in one way or another, maybe these people are starting to get the message that we're getting tired of living in an incarceration state.
Right.
With that, I yield.
Okay, thank you very much. And with that, California Fred, you are unmuted. Go ahead.
My question is for Brent. I really am angry with the sheriff in El Paso or in San Antonio, the one that wants to protect a sanctuary city. But the thing is, it stands because Sheriff Mack was able to challenge Bill Clinton on the Brady Bill or the assault weapons. So that makes me think the sheriff really does have power, and now the federal government is trying to write legislation to make laws that will throw that sheriff in prison. Now, just as we discover a sheriff has power and is using it for the wrong reason, how can we capitalize on it to make that sheriff protect our rights, or the sheriff goes to prison? I yield.
Well, I don't know exactly what's going on down there in Texas and El Paso, but I have gone in past years that experience in the courts of Arizona, the state courts of Arizona, and, well, Arizona mostly. And I can see that there's a struggle going on, has been going on there for a long time, between the Anglos and Mexicans. And the Mexicans have gained control of the judgeships in some of those places, and they're working and have been working with the drug cartels. And American judges, I say Anglos, I shouldn't say completely, because I'm sure there are some Mexican-Americans that are on the side of the Americans to try to stop the drug trade and the control of the border by the cartels, and it's clear now that they control the borders, who goes across either way. And the courts in El Paso, I can't imagine, I've been there, but I can't imagine it be any different there. As a matter of fact, it's probably worse. But this is serious business. We are being overrun in our country like we've never been overrun before by Islamic law, run over. It comes on us. It's coming at us. Islamic law, under the labels, law of the city in every case, Islamic law, Roman law, and Pharisaic law, which is Babylonian Judaism. All three of them are the same, fundamentally the same. All three of them arose in their modern form at the same time in Europe. The leading rabbi in Europe of that time, Mohammedes, the leading Romanist of that time, St. Thomas Aquinas, and the leading Islamic sage of that time from northern Africa, a fellow by the name of Averroes, introduced the whole idea of Roman law and the law of the city, the writings of Plato and Aristotle, into Europe. And through these two men, Mohammedes and Aquinas, and these have become the official doctrines in modern times. And those are the doctrines. Things haven't changed since ancient times on the island of Britain, when the Normans tried to take over the courts and push the Roman law into England, which they tried about seven centuries before that, even. They couldn't do it. They tried to do it through the church, tried to bring the church in Britain under the canon law. That was in the 7th century. And they got the southern half of the island to go along. The northern half of the island, led by a fellow named Coleman, he
he packed his bags and went home and said he wasn't going to have the top of his head shaved. He wasn't going to put on the cowl. And the struggle has been going on ever since, and now we're facing it in our country like we've never faced it before. But it's not coming at us just as one of those. Now, when Magna Carta was signed under King John had, this is amazing. King John had hocked up the taxpayers, landholders of England, to the Sultan of Morocco under a promise that all England would be Islamic if he would loan him all the money, if the Sultan would loan him all the money, King John, all the money he needed to fight the landholders of England. At the same time, he had done the same thing to the Pope of Rome. Rome had provided him all the money he wanted if he would but simply ensure that he obeyed the Pope, which he kind of committed himself to doing already anyway, but it was kind of back and forth in England, different than the continent. And at the same time then, he was hocked up entirely at up to 83.25% interest per year, hocked up to the Jewish moneylenders in England. Now, all of this is detailed, not all of it, about the Jewish moneylenders. That's part of Magna Carta. You can go read that. And that was a system. The Jewish people were allowed to lend money on interest, and then the Englishmen weren't because they were Christian. The Bible forbids usury. And the usury wasn't lawful in England. And at common law, it wasn't lawful until Oliver Cromwell. But all three of the people, for all three of the same reasons, and it all comes down to the law of the city. King John had sold his country out to them, all three of them. And the same fundamental problem we face today, we face the law of the city. And the law of the city is what the evil empire wants in America worse than anything else. All the screaming and holler and gnashing of teeth that people have, and they miss the quiet infiltration of the law of the city. It comes slow, but it comes by land. Is it any wonder that our federal bench is filled with people who are committed in their heart of hearts religiously to the law of the city? Well, look at the Supreme Court of the United States. The people there religiously are committed to the law of the city, even Justice Scalia. He was a man that was confused. He did a lot of right things. He wanted to do right. He said the right things, but in his heart of hearts, he had one foot in the evil empire and had it in the evil empire since his childhood. And he had a hard time getting his foot out, and eventually cost him his life because he really sincerely tried to do right. That's what we face today. He didn't die for nothing. The evil empire wanted him dead. They had to get rid of him. They were going to teach all of us that that's what happens when you devote yourself to principles of the common law, as Justice Scalia strove to do. And I appreciate him. I don't want people to misunderstand. But at the same time, he had an inward, internal struggle in his own life with the law of the city. And we face it now. It's coming on us. It's coming at us. And we want to get caught up in politics, of course. It's interesting and fascinating. But if we get distracted by politics, and that, by the way, is a doctrine of the law of the city, to politicize everybody. Matter of fact, the word politics means city. Polis. Polis. Politics is all about the polis. It is that system. We're not to reform that system. The Creator wants us to replace it. He doesn't want us to reform anything. He doesn't even want us to reform ourselves. He wants to replace our desires with a new desire, a new heart, a new understanding, a new mind, and to do things a different way, a totally 180 degrees contrary to what the evil empire wants, the empire of the evil one. Well, this is what we're up against, and it is up to us individually to quietly but intensely learn the fundamental differences. And by the way, there is nothing more than the fundamental differences and just how you apply them. A while ago, John did a good job. This is what people do. They said, what is due process? And the best answer that anybody can give in a short sentence is notice and an genuine opportunity to be heard. Because if you get notice and a genuine opportunity to be heard, all the rest of the course of the process is possible. But if you don't get that, nothing is possible as a matter of common law, due process. And that's what will subvert, and that's the ultimate thing. Guns are good. Oh, that's good. Yes, it is. The Second Amendment's good, that we have that right to keep and bear arms. But the ultimate battle comes down to those things that men tend to overlook, and it is the law. And every man is a lawyer, whether he understands it or likes it or not.
You can't stay alive if you're not a student of the law of the city. You can't make a living and you can't stay alive. You have to deal with it all day, every day. The laws of gravity, the laws of perpetual motion. When you're driving your car, that's why you're alive and you've been driving for years, because you understand the danger of the laws of perpetual motion if you get on the wrong end of a Mack truck or a Greyhound bus. Well, it comes down also to relationships, and that's what our common law courts, of course, deal with, as well as the laws of nature. But it's up to us to make the difference, and I leave you with that and yield up somebody else.
Okay. Thank you for that, Brent. Let me go to the next question here. It's somebody with the ending of 8803. You've been unmuted. Hello? 8803.
Can you hear me?
I can now.
My name is Felicia. I'm from Florida. I am a new member. Okay. How are you gentlemen doing this evening?
Good. Good to have you. Welcome.
I actually listened in last Monday, and you guys answered a couple of my questions that I sent Mr. Jan. One was about how Barack Obama can serve two terms, and his father was not a U.S. citizen.
Right.
And I think somebody said it was fraud. But my question is, I've been taking the constitutional course. I've taken a constitutional course, and I've read things about Thomas Jefferson, and I've read a whole lot of things about a lot of stuff that I definitely was not taught. And I'm on a civics course now, but my thing is if this country was founded on the basis of natural law and God's law, how is it that the 13th, the first constitution was pretty much brushed under the door, and they made a new one to pretty much enslave everybody in this country? My thing is, so they're against God, right?
Well, absolutely. I look at that finger has always been in there, just like the devil was in the Garden of Eden. There's never a time when they're not trying to influence things. And so that's what we're suffering under, is the fact that they're always trying to get their fingers into a crack and pull the armor up and get into us, which they do very well, because we know that power and principality is what runs the governments of the world. Otherwise, the devil wouldn't have been able to take Christ up to the mountain and say, I'll give you all this, if he wasn't controlling it in the first place. So let's not forget that's, you know, we're always going to have this struggle between good and evil. And so, you know, America is the only other nation in the world besides Israel that formed under these principles of God, these godly principles, and said, look, this is what we're going to follow, and these are our maxims, our laws. And so that's what's made us great, and it's what's made us special. And look, they've been trying to tear that down since the beginning. So, yeah, I mean, look, the whole Civil War thing was designed to make us all slaves. It wasn't fought to free the slave. It was fought to enslave the rest of us. This whole business of civil rights, it's all baloney. You don't have civil rights. You have God-given rights. I don't care what color you are. Everybody gets them. So that, you know, the 14th Amendment, it gives you due process. No, we had due process before the 14th Amendment. What the 14th Amendment did was turn people into United States citizens under the District of Columbia, and they don't even realize it. So there's been a lot of fraud. There's been a lot of amendments that were snuck through. You know, look at the Federal Reserve System was done on a Christmas Eve on an island off the shore of North Carolina. I mean, they're always at it. They're never going to stop. It's up to us to be vigilant and to expose them and to fight them, because freedom's not free, and that's the whole deal. If it was easy, you know, everybody would do it. You know? Anyway, I don't know if I answered your question with all that, but yeah.
But we all do have free will, and that is something that God gave all of us, correct? So
That's my thing, right.
Why is God allowing these things to happen? And I hear a lot of people saying the battle's not yours, it's the Lord's, it's the Creator's. But it's like, why, if we have free will, why are we being oppressed by Satan or the devil or this other entity that tried to prove himself greater than a creator? So,
Because of the fact that we have free will, and look, at the devil doesn't necessarily concentrate on you or me. He concentrates on those people who are in a position to use their free will to destroy the system. So those people, the reason that those people are in there exercising their free will in the wrong direction, and what's the rest of us doing? Sitting on our hands saying, oh, please save me, God? God, look, to whom much is given, much is expected. And you have a certain duty under piety and to correct these other people. You know, if every man in this country is a sovereign, if we're all supposed to be kings, God gave you a talent. And one of the talents he gave you by being born here or coming here is freedom. If you bury that talent and hide it and then you lose it, that's your problem. You see, you're supposed to take that talent and you're supposed to grow it and you're supposed to seed it and you're supposed to make it multiply. But because we're not protecting what God gave us, because we're not protecting our palaces, we're not putting on the armor of God, we're suffering our own consequences. We are reaping what we sow, and a lot of it is due to ignorance. You know, we're laziness and ignorance. My people perish due to their ignorance because it's so much easier to let somebody else do it. Look at even going to the doctor. I'm telling you, people don't want to be responsible for their health. Here, I'm yours, doctor. I'll do whatever you say. And most of the time, that's not a good thing. If you don't take responsibility for your own home and listen to what you're saying, that doctor's going to run tests to cover his butt so that he doesn't get a malpractice suit. And some of those tests that he's running are actually to your detriment. So if you don't know anything and you just throw yourself in his hands and you expect him to take care of yourself, take care of you as good as he would take care of himself, then you don't understand human nature. Nobody's going to take care of you better than you will take care of you. And don't expect anybody ever to. Okay? That's the problem right there.
You know, I went to University of Phoenix, and I did a lot of research on things that was not in the standard teaching from my professors. And even the professors didn't know who the CFR was.
Yeah, imagine that.
Everybody called me a conspiracy theorist. Oh, she's crazy. She hasn't. And I'm like, I have credible. I did the research. I have all this information. You know, you teach us to research things. I have all the references. How? And I do a PowerPoint presentation, a paper, and you tell me I'm crazy. But then, you know, years later, you found out that RFID technology is actually in your cell phone. And it's at Walmart, and that's how they do their distribution. I did a paper on this, but now you see these things, but I'm crazy. So I'm crazy.
And
but,
almost every one of our leaders is a member of the CFR. Anybody who's anybody is a member of that organization, but they don't know what it is, right?
My professors didn't even know who it was. I had professors.
Either they didn't know or they were just lying because they didn't want you to know.
No, they really didn't know. Like, they was asking me questions after class. They really didn't know. But my thing is, you know, I was in the police academy in the 90s. I went to the police academy because I wanted to find the guy that, you know, murdered my father when I was 12. And when I got into the police academy, I realized that it wasn't something that I wanted to be a part of. I mean, I still have my literature. I still have my books. And, it's so funny that, you know, when on my birthday, I actually went down to the courthouse and had my affidavit signed from the courthouse. But I was dressed down. You know, I had on a pair of shorts, sneakers. I had on my, you know, I ride a bicycle because my car is broke. And they charged me $20. I went in there last week 1 week after, and I wore my old shirt from the 90s from the police academy, and my affidavit was signed for free. And I was like, are you sure? She's like, no, it's free. I was like, okay, well, I just came in there last week, but you charged me $20 to sign the same exact affidavit, but I changed my shirt, and I come in, and now it's free.
Boy, that tells the story.
Got any more shirts?
Yeah.
It's free? So I have two of them. You know, I saved them. You know, I still have my list. I'm like, so, you know, I don't understand it, but I understand it because I think they thought I was a part of them, but when I looked like a bum, I was just like a regular other person on the street that was probably a criminal, but they didn't even acknowledge who I was because I'm an educated person. I went to college. I had a basketball scholarship. I went to college right out of high school. But, you know, I went to the police academy, quit school, took care of my son, went back to school, took care of my son, went back to school, and then I finally did it on my own. And then I come out here to move out from Orlando because I want a better life for my son and I. And I went to the first-time home buyers program in Orlando. It turned out to be a scam. I came out to Lake County. They gave me, you know, some kind of voucher, you know, for the first-time home buyer program. But then they turned around and told me I had to put $10,000 down before they even started building my house. So I took $10,000 out of my account for them to start building. Come to find out, you know, through my own ignorance, that they never even gave me a loan. It's like, why am I paying you money? Why am I paying a mortgage? And you guys never even gave me a loan. Why I'm in debt? And to come to find out that the note that I signed had legal tenure. So where's the money that you invested in it? Where is it? And I've been going through this for years. I've been in foreclosure 3 times. The first time I went to the courthouse, and the lawyer that my bank hired, so-called bank, because it's not a bank, they didn't even know I was making payments. They just threw it out. Second time I was making payments, they took money out of my account the next couple of months I was put in foreclosure, and they were still taking money out of my bank account and left me in foreclosure for almost three years. Who does that?
Well, they're having fun doing it. The bankers, it's another banking scheme. You know, this is a free-for-all. This is like chaos, like tyranny, because we're in this long, sucking spiral down, and it's every man for himself now, and they're just blatantly breaking the law. They're on a crime spree like Thelma and Louise or Bonnie and Clyde. That's what they are. They don't care.
I wrote TFPD. They lie. They lie. All they do is lie. I'm like, really? So, you know, I wrote a letter to CFPB. I'm like, how are you going to put me in foreclosure? You know, taking payments out of my account, getting no money from, you know, the program. Well, we never hired that law office. And I'm like, okay, well, it's in the court system, and here is the document that you did, in fact, hire that law office. And they're still getting away with it. How is that possible?
Well, that's right. There's no consequences. That's the problem. That's why we're here. That's what has to happen. You know, there has to be consequences. If there's no consequences, then it's never going to stop. They're going to go as long as they can get away with it. So that's what this is all about, is providing those consequences and raising people's perception and knowledge to the problem and the solution. Like Brent says, the only cure for lawlessness is law. And that's what we're about, putting the law back in. And you can't tell me they don't know they're breaking the law. They know. It's just that they don't care because there's no consequences. If I say, you know, if we got this law, this and that, well, what happens if I break it? Well, nothing. So who's going to not break it then? It's a joke.
How is this being allowed? How is this being allowed?
How's this been? I don't understand this.
Well, look it. There are people. There are victories coming slowly and here and there. But you know, it's being allowed because like I said, we're reaping what we've sowed. We've allowed them to dumb down our children. We've allowed them to take our morals away. You know, once they get three generations of children away from us, and they got them convinced that we're stupid, their parents are stupid, nobody knows anything but them, and they're the smartest thing since sliced bread and all that, and the ones that went before them are stupid. So that way they're brainwashing them into a certain way, into materialism. And you know, look at if everybody just turned their TVs off and the advertisements, we'd be a lot better off. That's why it's going on, because people are being programmed exactly the way they want them to be, and they're putting stuff in their heads that they're just not paying attention. As long as they got their beer, their cigarettes, and their football and baseball and all this stuff, they don't care. And, I mean, they're caring now because they're losing their jobs. When the economy goes down, everybody's going to care when there's no food in the refrigerator. Look at what happens to people. What always happened to the Jews when they disobeyed God? He sent them punishment. And one of the punishments he sends them is war. War is a punishment for not paying attention and for sitting, because that's what happens. You end up in war, and then you end up in famine and all this other horrible stuff that will be visited on a country that, you know, God used many different nations to punish the Jews, the Philistines, this one, that one, the Syrians, to kick their butts, because when they deserved it, that's what they got. And I mean, if we could, I don't know how we're still here, because from what I see and what you're talking about, what everybody's talking about, and all the crime and all the things that go on in this country, I don't know how we're still standing, how we could sit here and not suffer the consequences of these things. You know?
I think America needs to repent.
Well, they're going to repent one way or the other. That's all I can tell you. I know that more people are waking up. I know that more people are praying. I know that for a fact. How many people is enough people? I don't know. But the thing is there's still major, large factions of society that just don't have it right. They don't understand
it. All it takes is one.
What's that?
All it takes is one.
Well, you know, that's what this is about, because there's many people that would, if they had the information, they would rise to the occasion. So it's up to us to go out and to make that noise and to educate them. And you know, by holding your public officials' feet to the fire, that's how you educate them and your neighbors. You know what I mean? Committees of safety are those things where you get together with your neighbors and you work on them, and that's how you save America one county at a time. You know
when I moved out here where I'm living at now, you know, I remember going into the library and there was this old elderly guy walking into the library. He had his cane. He can barely walk. And I watched two able-bodied people walk past him. And I got up off the computer in the library, and I was like, excuse me, sir, you need any help? And I helped him to the computer. He sat down, and he was there for like 2 hours. And after he left, the librarian was like, do you know who that was? And I was like, you know, I was upset because I was like, you know, it's an old man. Nobody would help him. And she told me who he was, and he was a former NASA astronaut from here in Florida and Cape Canaveral. And I was like, what? And I was like, wow. I was like, he's going to be here. She's like, he comes here every day. He came the next day. He asked me my name. He told me he remembered me, and he mentored me for 2 years. And he became a whistleblower because NASA took his pension away and left him with $1,200 a month in Social Security. So he became a whistleblower, and he started telling the truth about what's really going on at NASA. And he's like the second top Freemason in space. I think Buzz is under him. And I've seen pictures, and I used to laugh at him
you know, when I first started talking to him, he used to call me stupid, and he used to always say how America has been dumbed down to idiots. That's his favorite quote. America has been dumbed down to idiots. They're not telling our kids the truth. They're lying. They're lying. They're not telling to, you know, he became a whistleblower, but, you know, he's told me a lot, and, you know, I don't see him too much often, but sometimes I go and take him something to eat because his own kids don't do that for him. You know, there's a lot of things that I know from that point of view, but there's a lot of things that I didn't know coming up my entire life. And, you know, for me to have had that information in my face the whole time, and it seems like, you know, people in a position such as teachers and professors have deterred me from actually knowing what the truth is. So when I, you know, seen Mark Emery's video about Beat the Bangers, I was like, what? It's a scam? I'm giving them free money? And I don't have food in my refrigerator to eat because, you know, the food stamp office reduced my food stamps down to $21 a month, and I only made $8 from change an hour. And then I have student loan people taking money out of my account that reduce out of my straight out of my account that reduce me to $217.50 a week out of almost $400. So they pretty much have financially crippled me into doing what I have to do. But I made sure I borrowed that money to send Mr. Jan because I really support this organization based on the things that I've heard and the things that I've been going through with. So,
well, we thank you very much, and we're coming on past 12 o'clock now, and I would say you had your Helen Keller moment. You're fully awake, so.
Yes, I'm awake. I'm a night crawler.
Yeah, so.
Keeping it up.
Just have fun. Just have fun getting freedom. You got to have fun doing it. Otherwise, it's not worth doing. So, you know.
Yes, sir.
Believe me, it could be fun putting these people back in their place. You know what I mean?
It's not fun to me. It's not fun to me because I've been through a lot of trials and tribulations. This business.
Yeah, I understand that, but you got to find the bright spots along the way, and they're there. You'll find them. Believe me, it'll keep you going. But anyway. Thank you for your call. We appreciate it. And welcome aboard. We're glad to have you.
No problem. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Good night. God bless. Okay, everybody. Thank you for coming. I'm gonna sign off here. It's 12:05, so we're 5 minutes over. Thank you, everybody. I'm sorry if we missed anybody. We'll catch you on the next round. Have a good night.
Good night.